Well, this evening I want to thank everybody who is on the call with us. This evening we're looking at hearing about the results that Dwayne's going to talk about with some greenhouses we're working on. And we're looking at the link between greenhouse productivity and the soil conductivity, fertigations, and foliar sprays. Dwayne, can you just kind of start off by talking a little bit about these greenhouses? Are they brand new greenhouses, or just a little bit about the two, number one and number two greenhouse?
Okay. There's 30 by 96 greenhouses that were put up not quite a year ago, I believe. And so they're new greenhouses. They're pretty deluxe. They have cool cells. They have computer-controlled ventilation systems. They're nice. And they started out to raise tomatoes. And that brings up a point. They put these greenhouses on where they used to feed cattle. And a barnyard isn't always the best place to put up a greenhouse. And most times it isn't. So anyway, they had some problems from day one. They had aphids. They had other problems, which included, let me think. I don't really know what everything was, but anyway, they had some serious issues with the high potassium and all that they were addressing.
So let's just call. I want to get a list of lessons learned out of this. I think you just hit the very first one, and that is, if you're going to put up a greenhouse, probably avoid old barnyards, just so that you don't have to deal with the problems of all the excess potassium and what that leads to.
Yeah. Somebody called in and they were having a problem getting on the conference, so that kind of distracted me. Sorry about that.
Okay.
But yeah, that's lesson number one. Don't put it on where you fed hogs or calves or anything like that. And
okay.
So they didn't have a crop in the number one greenhouse or in the number two greenhouse. They put in some green beans. I don't know. They went through some serious issues. And anyway, they called me in January. And they had planted the second crop of tomatoes in greenhouse number one. They had planted it in October, I believe. September or October. And this was January 12th. And so I went over there and they had tomato plants that were 10 to 12 feet tall. And I would say 5 to 7 tomatoes on a plant, maybe 5 tomatoes on a plant average. Not setting any flowers. And they just weren't getting any production at all. The leaves were turning brown. And they were pinching those off. And one of the big problems that they had, I believe, is they didn't know where they were or why they were where they were. They didn't know why. So
they explain that again. They didn't know what? What weren't they knowing?
They didn't know why the leaves were turning brown. They didn't know why they didn't have any production.
What stage were the tomatoes in when they were not getting production?
Well, they were no longer setting flowers, and they weren't having any small tomatoes anymore. So there was just a couple ripe ones and a couple that were green and getting ripe, but they weren't.
So they were in the stage where they should be setting quite a bit of flowers.
Yes.
Okay, so they were what, pretty tall already, and
yeah, about 12 foot.
Okay.
And they just kind of stopped growing at that point. And so the first thing I did was take the soil conductivity. measured the energy level in the soil, and that was 120. And on tomatoes of that size, it should be probably at 700 or more.
So you had 120 on the herbs.
Yes.
And for just so the case of a few people here who don't know what that means, can you just briefly explain what you just did with taking herbs?
Taking the herbs, Dr. Reams described herbs, ERGS, as energy released per gram per second, per gram of soil per second. And so that's a measurement of the energy in the soil that is available for plant growth. It's a relative number. It's not necessarily an absolute number that it means this and this and this, but it's a relative number that we can go by. If it's low, it's low. If it's high, it's high, and so forth. It's not exactly. You don't need 452 or 503, but you need to get your ranges correct. So I was measuring the energy in the soil. We like to have a bottom limit of 200 on herbs, and this was at 120, and plant growth had almost stopped. Go ahead.
Okay.
Did you say something, John?
I did not.
I heard something.
I did as well. I've read something recently that urge does not equal plant energy, but from what you found, at 120, there was no growth.
Almost none, and the plant was dying.
Plants were dying.
They were dying from the bottom up, of course. And the pH was 7.8. So pH, as Dr. Reams defined it, and I find that to be very accurate, is it tells you the level of resistance to the flow of energy. Above 6.5, you have more resistance. Below 6.5, you have less resistance. So we had an energy of 120. We had a pH of 7.8. So we had high resistance to the energy that was there already, and there wasn't much energy there at all. And so those plants were basically dying right there.
It should also be pointed out that, why don't you tell how, what's the density of those tomatoes?
Okay, they're planted in beds. A foot, there's a row, there's two rows per bed. They're planted a foot apart in each row. So in a 2 foot square, there's four plants. Still there?
Okay, I was getting some emails that were saying they weren't getting on, so I just locked and unlocked. So maybe I sent everybody off. I don't know. But going back to the you're talking one tomato plant every foot in the row.
And in the row, and then another row a foot beside it. Mm-hmm. That's the way a
lot of... So it's a double row of two rows then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A double row with one plant every foot in each row.
That's amazing. And so then how much walkway is there between the rows?
They have fairly wide walkways in that greenhouse. I believe it's over 3 foot. A little over 3 foot. So they have wider in that one than a lot of the growers do.
And do you offhand know how many tomato plants were in there?
625.
Oh, wow. You do know.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So the plants were dying, the leaves were turning brown, and the conductivity was 120. And there was virtually no tomatoes. Apparently there were some. Did you check the Brix reading on the tomatoes that were, the few that were being harvested?
I didn't, but a friend of mine did, and the highest he found was a 2.
A 2.
Mm-hmm.
You know, prior to this, I'd never heard of that low of a tomato brick.
I hadn't either.
Okay, Dwayne, can you speak a little closer to the phone?
Sure. Is this better?
Okay. Yeah, I want to hear it just a little bit louder.
Okay.
Okay. So what did you do then, or what was the first thing you did when you came to that greenhouse?
Well, the first thing I did was take the herbs, and then take the pH, and then I started asking questions. And I asked him, what are you doing? You know, why is it looking like this? And what are you putting through? And so on and so forth. And one thing that stuck out to me was that he was putting Epsom salts through, and quite a lot of it. He was putting a quart of Epsom salts through each week. That was 16 ounces, I believe, on Tuesday, and then 16 ounces on Friday. And we had brown leaves. So he had been doing that for 2 months, so I knew that that wasn't the problem. If it would have been the problem, it would have fixed it. But obviously, it wasn't fixing it. And so, right off, I knew that the high pH was a problem. We needed to work on that. I knew the energy was the biggest problem. We had to get the herbs up one way or the other. And so, the first thing we did is just went in with a simple nutrient drench called Inferno. And we put a quart of that through the drip line. And this is basically 1,000 square feet wettable area under those drip tapes. And so we put a quart of Inferno in there. And on the 13th, this is the 12th, of January, and on the 13th of January, I saw a flower in there.
And that was some of the first flowers you saw?
Yes, 24 hours later, that was the first. Yeah, there were no flowers in there, period. None. But I found.
I'm going to clarify what Inferno is. It's a sulfuric acid-based fish with extra acidity, extra sulfuric acid, just a little bit to drop the pH a little lower.
And we also put in Percup there at the beginning.
Really? Now, did you put that in at a separate time or just the same time?
Separate time.
Okay. That Percup is a calcium nitrate-based liquid with carbohydrates added, so it's to supply some available calcium.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that you started with a pH of, is that 7.8?
Yes.
So it's a very high pH.
Mm-hmm. And by January 20th, we had the pH down to 6.9, or it came down to 6.9. The erg was up to 370, and we had approximately 15 flowers on every plant, and the flowers were wide open. And the foliage was greening up, and the growth was starting to take off.
And so on the drip tape, is there like emitters are on each plant then? Just one emitter? A hole?
They're not exactly placed by every plant. A lot of the drip tape has, well, you can get emitters at 12-inch centers or 8-inch centers. Some have them at 4-inch centers. I'm not sure what Gary has over there. 12 or 8, I guess. So it would be close. Another thing I should mention is the soil they have is a sandy clay almost, if there's anything like that. It's not really a loam, but it's almost like a sandy clay. And so it percolates very well. And so
the drain's good.
Yeah, these fertigations went right down in there into the root zone.
And did you do any foliar sprays in the first few days?
No, we didn't do a foliar spray until the 20th. Started the 12th, and then the 20th we did the first foliar. And we used your Brix Blaster and Enthuse to encourage more flowers. And the first thing we noticed the next day is that we had the ergs up to 370. and it dropped 130 points overnight after we did that foliar. Now, if it was just because of the foliar or if it was just a coincidence, I'm not sure. But I am sure that the tomatoes were starting to form. And that's one thing I learned out of this, is when the tomatoes start to form, you really have an energy pull right at that point. You can put on flowers, you can maintain ergs, you can maintain growth, but when those tomatoes start to form, those seeds start to form, that energy demand goes up, oh, three, four times as much.
I would imagine then with the Brix Blaster and Enthuse, it probably stimulated more development of blossoms and setting seed of fruit, and could have dropped the ergs right from that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. Because it's just to develop a seed takes much more energy than to grow a plant. So that's something you really have to watch. When seeds start to develop on a plant, then you need to make sure that you're keeping your energy up.
So what you're saying, it sounds like what you're saying is one of the things that you learned is that based on the physiology of the plant, the level of ergs required in the soil varies.
Yes, yes, we did learn that also, definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you're just growing greens, you can do it on a lot less than you can if you're growing fruit. I mean, you could have kale and lettuce and collards in there, and it wouldn't take near the energy that it does to grow seeds.
Okay, and would you say that as you go along in a tomato where you are going to grow seeds, but when you start it, you may need a different baseline of energy as compared to further on in the tomato production?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Once you have your tomato plant hanging full of tomatoes, you need to have your baseline. I don't have an exact figure, but it looks, I sure like to have it 300 points higher on the ergs than just when you're growing your young tomatoes. Just as a generalization, I like to have at least.
Okay, assuming there's no sodium as a problem, so it's not a high sodium soil, would you be comfortable that early growth on tomatoes would be, say, 250 ergs would be adequate?
It's also dependent on the nitrates, but that would be barely. I'd like to have it 300.
300?
250 would be crowding the bottom in my mind. A lot of the water that people use to water will have that much ergs. And so you have to be careful where your ergs is coming from. If your water is 300 on the meter, well, then to grow young plants, you're going to need probably 350 or a little bit more to do it right.
So there's a lot of variables is what you're saying.
There's a huge amount of variables.
Okay.
If you have put down the dry broadcast before you planted your small tomatoes, then it's not as important, because I know then that the foundation is down and that the ergs isn't going to drop as quickly. And then, I would agree with you. If you have the broadcast down, you put in young tomatoes and the ergs is 250 and they're doing well, don't worry about it.
Well, that's another thing we should point out is that when we started working with the greenhouse, there was no way to put a broadcast down because it was already covered with plastic.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to do just drip work and foliar sprays.
Mm-hmm.
So then, I believe you pulled the soil sample about that time somewhere.
I pulled the soil sample the first day.
First day.
Uh-huh. But then the soil sample came back probably about the 23rd, something like that, and we were struggling with the energy. These plants were starting to put on tomatoes, and the herbs was down around 200, a little under 200, a little over 200, and we just couldn't get it up. And so we started foliar feeding. We were doing one fertigation a day, and so we stepped that up to two fertigations a day, and we started that in, let me see here. We started that at the 30th of January. We started doing two fertigations a day.
I see. So you then let's go ahead and just kind of describe what is the difference between the two fertigations.
Okay, the one fertigation, number one fertigation, we put in growth energy. Primarily, it's micronized limestone and other growth elements. In number two fertigation, we put in reproductive energy. And that is to work those two against each other to create more energy. That's the point. We were struggling with the energy levels here. We needed to do something different to get that up. And so fertigation number one is growth energy package. And the reason we can't run those two together is because sometimes you make cottage cheese, or you make cheese, or you make mud, or you do something that will plug up the drip line. So you can't run, for instance, you can't put micronized lime in with 511 fish, or I mean, excuse me, the dram fish, the 25.2 high phos fish. I had a farmer put those two together last fall, and his nurse tank boiled over. It cooked over the top, and he lost about 200 gallons of his mix there. So that's why you can't put those two together. You have to do them separately.
So maybe another lesson maybe out of all this is when you're first starting off, you may want to have a good consultant to guide you through some of this. Would you agree with that as a pretty good lesson?
Yes, yes. Often the farmer is, what shall I say? You know, he can't really see what he needs to see. It helps to get an outside eyes in, or somebody that hasn't been working in here every day to come in, take a look at it, and pass opinion on it.
So we need some outside eyes and some just so you people have seen it all the time, they can get some help from a consultant to understand some of the Reams principles.
Yes. I sure like to do that on my own. I like to get outside opinions, and it really helps. You need to do it. You really need to do it.
I agree. We got a question here that came in. How does sodium affect the ERG's requirements? So if, let's say that instead of having low sodium, what if it was higher sodium in the greenhouse? What would we be doing for the ERG's, for the base levels?
Well, what sodium does is pushes the number higher on the meter. That is simply, I mean, for the language that as farmers can understand, or as produce growers can understand, it pushes the number higher on the meter and does nothing for the plant. Now, one of my sayings is never say never and never say always. So when I say something, it does nothing for the plant. Sometimes it might do something for the plant, but for all practical purposes, it's not helping us by putting a higher number on the meter. Therefore, it's very important to know what that sodium level is, so you know if I go in, for instance, I'd have gone into this greenhouse, plants are 12 feet tall, they're dying off at the bottom, no tomatoes, no flowers, the bumblebees can't live in there because there's no flowers to pollinate and whatever, and that ERG's reading would have come up 450. I would have known that there is something in there that's pushing the number high on the meter that is not contributing to the plant's health. And so you do have to take that in consideration. I would have done the same thing. I would have established a baseline. Okay, I've got a reading of 450 and nothing's happening. That means we have to go up. There's only one way to go. Sodium can help. Well, you know, it can help in the taste, but it's a minor. And the other big lesson I got out of this is, and this one is a really big lesson. You have to realize that all growth, all formation of matter is the creation of new cells. And that sounds simple in the extreme. But if you're not creating more fruit, if you don't have growth, you're not forming new cells. Okay, so what about it? Well, this is what about it. Nitrogen is the number one element it takes to form a new cell. So if you're not forming new cells, you probably have a nitrogen problem. Not probably, you have a nitrogen problem. I'm not saying that in every time you're going to be low, but I'm going to say you're going to have a nitrogen problem. That was a huge lesson for me. Anytime you look at any plant and it's not growing, then you don't have new cell formation. And that you need to think about that and really think about that, because then you start to see this picture that you have to create new cells, and then you need to know how to create new cells. And that's where you guys up at International Ag Labs helped me so much, to understand what elements it takes to form new cells. Then you can start putting in what you need and go from there. It's all about life at the cellular level. Maybe I'm getting a little bit ahead, but I sure wanted to bring that out.
Well, I wrote it down because I've got a whole list of lessons learned, and I've already got six of them so far.
That's the most important one that I saw out of this whole thing. Now, back to that sodium issue. So, if you have 450 on the ergs, and you're still not making new cells, then your energy on that meter is registering is a false, or it's not usable by the plant to create new cells. So we have to go on top of that with the correct elements to start forming more new cells.
So that can come from sodium as well as high conductivity water.
It can, and it can come from nitrate. And nitrates in and of itself, they'll push a plant growth if you have potassium there. But sometimes, I learned this lesson last year. I had a grower with high nitrates in his water. It really didn't push huge, lush plant growth like you'd expect from a high nitrogen situation, but it pushed the ergs extremely high in his soil in the greenhouse. And it didn't grow very well? Not very well. Not very well. He got a crop, but it wasn't a very good one. It was a struggle. And so he had his water tested, and now he found out that there's high nitrate, so that now it all falls together. That's why we were getting high ergs readings, and the plants weren't doing very well. So in that greenhouse, we had to establish a baseline on the meter of about 800. When it came down to 600, we had to start fertilizing, or the plants just stopped.
Okay. Now, would you say that this is why it's critically important to get a soil test, and so you know your baseline on your sodium and some of the other elements like the nitrogen and phosphorus, potassium, calcium? Those are some really key things.
Exactly. Without a good soil test, you're still out there hunting for mosquitoes in the dark of the moon with a blindfold over your eyes with a fly swatter.
Well, where I come from, northern Minnesota, you just go outside and they got you.
Well, I mean, trying to hit one with a fly swatter, maybe they're so thick you can just take a swipe at it.
What you do is you cover your mouth so you don't breathe them in.
Okay, well, that wasn't a good analogy. But anyway, you're lost without a good soil test, because there's no way to know your sodium levels, your nitrate levels, your potassium levels, your phosphorus levels. All of those play into that ERGS thing.
Really, so in other words, how you manipulate the conductivity, the way you, what ingredients you use, you go back to the soil test to determine where the weak points are and try to hit those as well as bringing the ERGS up.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Because if you try to push the ERGS, say you have high potassium and high nitrate to start with, and if you go in there with a high nitrate, high potassium product, you will probably push the ERGS up some, but you will just get a plant that the health of the plant will simply go down very fast. If you put on what is there in excess already, that is one good way to bring the health of the plant down.
Okay, so let's carry forward this story now. We started having some initial success. You saw blossoms, and then you started struggling as the tomato was filling the new tomatoes. You were struggling with the ERGS.
Mm-hmm.
What were you doing then to try to overcome that?
Well, when we got the soil test back, we were looking at a calcium level of around 1,000. We were looking at nitrates around 40. Ammonia, I believe, was at 4. Potassium and phosphorus were both a little high. 400, 500, 600, something like that. And so we thought, okay, what can we do? We really don't want to add nitrates, which I did a little bit of that initially. We really don't want to add potassium or phosphorus. We're very short on calcium. And we're very short on ammonium nitrogen, ammoniacal nitrogen, ammonia nitrogen. So, the first thing we did is starting adding micronized lime through the drip line. And that supplies calcium when it solubilizes, but to solubilize that, you have to have microbes, you have to have sugars, you have to have life there in the soil, and to have life in the soil, you have to have ERGS in the soil, and lime by itself does not raise the ERGS a whole lot, and it didn't, so we needed something to play against that lime so we could raise the ERGS. And so we started, of course, we started foliar feeding at the same time. And so we went in there with some ammonium sulfate, which is ammonia, nitrogen, and sulfates. And the sulfates are acidic, so they bring the pH down. And so we started bouncing that off the lime, so to speak, or working it against the lime. We fertigated the lime in the morning, and the bugs, and the sugar, and so on, and then in the evening we would put in ammonium sulfate. We put in a little bit of phosphorus even. The test was actually, I don't have the most recent test. Well, this is the most recent. I don't have the...
I have the first one, Dwayne.
What's the first one on the phosphorus?
It was 421, and then potassium was 377.
Okay, on the first one.
Yep.
So we had 421 on phosphorus, but we went ahead and added a little bit anyhow, just to try to get the ERGS up, because we needed something soluble to get the ERGS up.
You know, one of the things you may want to point out, when you're having such a high level of density of tomato plants and their 10-foot tall, and some of the rules of, you know, only maybe 200 pounds of phosphorus and potassium, that is such a little buffering that in greenhouses that are this intense,
I shouldn't have called that.
It should be a little higher.
Yeah. Oops. Did
Okay,
that?
I'm still here. You're there? So, you there, Dwayne?
Hello?
Okay, Dwayne, can you hear me?
Are you there, John?
I can hear you. Can you hear me? Dwayne? Okay. Looks like Dwayne got cut off. I'm going to look at a couple questions here. Roger had a question on what is the BRICS of the tomatoes now? And we're going to cover that, but we started with two BRICS tomatoes, which is the lowest I've ever heard of a tomato. And then through the course of time, it moved up to two to four BRICS. And
Chief John comes back on.
I'm back here. I'm here, Dwayne. Can anybody hear me? If you can, could somebody email me at Soil Restorer? Okay, thank you, Michael. I'm glad you sent me the email. Somebody can hear me. Okay, I'm going to just going to keep on talking a little bit I'm going to cover some of the questions. Thanks, David. I got your message. Dwayne, are you there? Okay.
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, you're back. Hey, great.
Yep, called.
I don't know what happened, okay, somebody want to email if you can hear both Dwayne and I. So everybody can hear, seems like they can hear me.
Okay. I had a call or two, people could hear me and they could hear you, but we couldn't hear each other.
Yeah, I could hear you, but you couldn't hear me.
No, I couldn't hear a thing, so I just
Okay. All right, so you were talking about, well, I can't even remember what you were talking about now.
Okay, we started talking about what we started adding in and why we started adding it in.
Okay, what you were doing to get the conductivity up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And I don't know how detailed you want to be, but basically what we did was pushed the, okay, we need to say that nitrate nitrogen pushes growth. Ammonia nitrogen produces seed. We did not need more growth. We needed more seed. We needed more fruit. And so we started putting ammonium sulfate in there. We started
okay,
putting,
so you took all nitrates out?
Yes, all.
Okay, good. That's an important thing.
Mm-hmm. All nitrates, because we had sufficient growth.
Okay.
And so we put 5-1-1 fish in there.
Okay.
And describe what that is, John. Well, we did want, no? Yeah, describe.
Well, that's an ocean fish that is, they take the oil out, and then they leave the meat on, and it's basically cooked and ground real fine, and then it's basically dehydrated down to a pretty low level of moisture, so it's about 50% solids. It's got sulfuric acid, so there's a lot of trace minerals. And so the meat then, of course, makes the nitrogen high as a 5-1-1. So it's an excellent fish for high nitrogen and amino acid form of nitrogen, too.
Yes, it's not just hard chemical nitrogen. And that is actually when we started seeing the ergs come up and stabilize. They crept up to 400, 450, 425. Then on up to 460 and then to 500.
Did you say then you were using both ammonium sulfate and fish?
Both.
Really? What quantities were you using?
We used a quart of 5-1-1 fish, and we used 16 ounces of ammonium sulfate.
For that greenhouse?
Every day, and the p.m. In the a.m., we were putting on the limestone and the bugs and the sugar and the liquid humates and so on. And then the PM we were putting on the reproductive growth.
And I might add that we still had the sugar and some another bug package in the second fertigation.
Yes, and
some humates.
We don't want to overemphasize one thing or the other. Without the bugs, without the sugar, without the humates, I don't think this would have worked. We're kind of hitting the high points and saying, okay, we needed nitrogen. And that is a high point, and it's a very important one. But I'm glad you brought that out. Without sugar and without bugs, it doesn't work either, or not nearly as good.
Okay. And were you in the second fertigation, were you also putting micronized ream in, broad-spectrum rock powder, or not at this point?
Yes.
Okay, then I'll describe that too, because it's just one of the things that we were doing. Micronized Remin is a broad-spectrum, finely ground rock powder, and it'd be kind of in the same family, similar to Azomite, if people know what that is. So that was going in. What rates were you using that in?
I believe that was 2 tablespoons.
Okay, and how much micronized limestone were you putting in?
We started out with 2 tablespoons. No, 2 teaspoons. We started out with 2 teaspoons. And that is 0.4 of an ounce. Yeah, we started out with 2 teaspoons. Today we're putting in 4 tablespoons of micronized lime. Just to try to, and now the issue is, with all the sulfates and with everything going in, and probably the bugs in the soil starting to work very well, the pH dropped from, we started at 7.8, and now it's running down around 5. And
okay.
So we bumped up the calcium to try to bring the pH back up, to create more resistance, and therefore we gain more energy.
Okay, I think what I hear you saying is another lesson, that intensive production in a greenhouse requires intensive monitoring. Would you agree?
Absolutely.
And so you're monitoring how frequently?
Daily.
And what were you checking every day?
We were checking the ERGs, the pH, and the ORP every day. Now the ORP, you can explain that, John, if you want to. That doesn't seem to, with this program, it seems that if you keep the ERGs where it needs to be, if you put in what needs to be put in, the ORP kind of takes care of itself.
I would agree that from what we're seeing that we don't really need to monitor the ORP, but we were experimenting. We thought maybe because it's under plastic it might need it. Our conclusion at this point is it's not a big issue at this point. Better to go with the pH and the ERGs, and if we just follow that based on what we see with the soil test, we're probably going to be okay. Okay, so you're monitoring every day. That's mm-hmm. a huge lesson. I mean, people don't think necessarily that they need to monitor that
and
every day.
And you don't have to. You don't have to. But then your production will not be... You get out of it what you put into it. That's the thing. And if you want, and this was a very difficult situation to jump in there right in the middle where there wasn't anything happening, and you had these plants that were 12 foot tall. It was almost like having a fleet of race cars all ready to go, and you brought a 55-gallon drum of gasoline in the back of your truck to fuel them all up. You couldn't keep up hauling fuel. That was about what it was like.
Do you realize a quart per day is 10 gallons an acre daily on liquid fish? Are you really sure you needed that much? I'm quizzing you. I'm taking the other side here. Just curious.
Well, all I can say is it's working. That's what I can say. The bricks and the leaves on January 12th, the bricks and the leaves were around 4 to 5.
Okay, I mentioned in the email 6, so I was wrong. So 4 to 5 was the bricks and the leaves.
It was hard, yeah. They were struggling to keep it at that level. That's the way I understood them anyway. And by February 28th, the bricks and the leaves was up to 11. So I'm not going to argue.
Okay. So the results are speaking for themselves. So we started with the bricks in the tomatoes. Chart now what do we got with tomato bricks and starting with what we the very beginning ones and then where we're at now. Bring it up to now.
The bricks to start with was 2 and under. 2 was about the highest you could find, and now we have some. We tested one here at home that was 6.1, and that's the highest one I tested. What we have now, and I picked the little bitty ones that don't sell, and it's interesting those little things that get kicked aside because they don't look as pretty, don't taste as good either.
Really?
They are the tail enders. Yeah.
Really? Now, did
There's
you
a reason
have your...
why a number one tomato is called a number one tomato.
Hmm. Have you checked now the larger size tomato to see just what the Brix is on those recently?
Yes. Gary gave me a yellow one just recently, a large, nice one. It's one of the yellow of one of the yellows there at the back end of the greenhouse, and that was 6.1. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it tasted better than the smaller ones that were.
Oh yeah, 4.9. Yeah, you can taste the difference from 4.9.
Oh, so you had a 4.9 on some of the smaller ones.
Uh huh. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the bigger ones were 6.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so we kept on doing that, and well, then we got hit with an ice storm. What was it, the end of February? Let's see. No. Let me see. When did we have the meeting up here in Branson?
February 20-something, 25th, 6th, 7th. And I saw the greenhouse on the 24th.
We got hit with an ice storm about the 6th and 7th and somewhere in that area of February. And the electricity went off. It went down to 39 degrees in there. And so we had a huge setback as far as yield. The flowers aborted because of the cold temperature, I guess. It took us almost 3 weeks, a little over 2 weeks, to get the flowers opening back up, nice and white and yellow. It took almost 3 weeks to get it going again real good. So right now we are harvesting that slump. Right now the harvest isn't too great because of that ice storm in February. But in the 25th of March, no, the 18th of March, the pH was going down a little under 5. And that's where you brought up the idea of putting in some milk. And so we started putting in some milk. And the pH did come up. It came up 5.3, 5.7, 5.0, 5.1. And what we saw by putting in that milk was that the tomatoes sized more rapidly and the Brix in the leaves came up further. And now we have a 15 Brix in the leaf. And actually, John, we're right in that harvesting slump, so I don't really have a nice big red tomato Brix right now. There's some ripening.
So you're harvesting the tomatoes that were put on during that slump and the time that they were behind.
Yes.
Okay. I got a question here. I just want to cover. David was curious about the phosphates on the greenhouse number one that we're talking about. On January 20th, which is, Dwayne must have taken this, maybe the 12th or 14th or somewhere around there.
12.
But 12. Okay. We had 421 pounds of phosphates and 377 pounds of potassium and 1,000 pounds of calcium, 1,063. And then fast forward, and do you want me to just give the numbers for the next soil test, Dwayne?
Sure.
Okay, in our lab we got it on the 20th of March, so it must have been pulled a little bit before that. And the phosphorus has dropped to 257, and the potassium dropped to 200, and the calcium dropped a whopping big loss down to 542.
So the phosphorus and potassium both dropped 200 points, right?
Basically, yes. 177 on the potassium. But the calcium went from 1,000 to 500, so it dropped significantly. And the pH is it's down to a 6.1. So the
actually,
pH
we're
is,
getting lower readings than that in the
You're getting lower readings, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wonder if sitting in that, going through the lab and stuff, maybe without roots pulling on it, maybe it had a tendency to kind of come back up a little bit. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that, but I'm just speculating out loud.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a big drop, but in the meantime, we're seeing quite a bit of production from the very first test in, basically it's 2 months, on our soil test, it's 2 months to the day. We had nothing, then we had quite a bit of production after we had a bunch of blossoms put on, and now we're going through a little bit of a lull because of that big frost. Or not frost, but a cold spell that went through the greenhouse.
The green, yeah, we had an ice storm and electricity went off, so the heat went off. But I was in there today, and there's now the first big clusters that came on after the ice storm are ripening now, and there's five clusters above that, or four clusters above that, five total average on every plant, and they're just loaded. They're really loaded, and they're sizing fast. So it looks good. It looks like the production will jump way back up again.
Okay, so what is the production on the 3,000 square foot? What are you seeing a few weeks before that was slowed down because of the ice storm consequences?
They picked 500 pounds out of there in a week.
500 pounds.
Mm-hmm. What amazing.
Okay.
That's not so big, you know. You growers that harvest more than that, you're thinking, oh, that's not that much, but what we have to remember here is we have a plant that was almost dead, that the bricks on the leaf was 4, that the bricks on the fruit was 2, and they weren't doing anything. And now, to pick it up that much, those plants have the ability to do that much just by increasing the energy with the correct nutrients based on the soil test, I think it's phenomenal. And I think they will see higher yields than that if they keep on doing this thing, you know, and pushing these plants. It looks good in there.
Okay, I want to clean up just a couple questions here. Is the 511 fish levels okay with organic certification? The fish itself is fine for organic certification. I don't know if they say how much nitrogen can be applied per area. If they do, I'm sure we're way over. But the soil required it, and the density of the plants required it in order to keep the energy up. So we'd have to check with certification. But if that was not kept up, I'm very positive that the ergs would have really gone down. The plants would not have been able to add on new clusters of blossoms, and the leaves, the bricks of the leaves would definitely have gone down because the energy has not been kept up. Next question, Roger, were you measuring the soil or pHs and ergs? We were doing everything with the soil. We were not measuring leaf pH or energy. And maybe you did, but it wasn't showing up on what your sheets here that you keep records of.
No, we didn't.
Okay, and so this leads up to one other thing I just mentioned, keeping records. One of the most important things to do when you're making all of going through this whole process is keep a detailed sheet of records of what was the things. So Dwayne and Gary and did they have date, time, the ERGs, the pH? They have ORP, but I think we can skip that. And then what was applied, and do this every day. And so that you'll go back and be able to learn a whole lot just by watching what was done in the past. Would you agree with that, Dwayne?
Absolutely. Records are extremely valuable as an educational tool. Extremely so.
Yeah.
The other thing I want to mention is I don't want anybody to jump on that micronized lime thing and run with it. We're putting on the equivalent now of 10 pounds per acre per day, the equivalent. That is not something you want to try in strawberries or in other plants. Tomatoes planted in this density will handle that, and they'll thrive on it. But be careful and don't take that and just run with it and put it on anything. I wanted to bring that up.
Yes, this is intensive production on a low calcium soil, and we're watching the soil test as well. So it's you got a good warning.
Another thing, if you start out with a soil that has 3,000 calcium, it will not take near as much additives, so to speak, or so much in the drip line to bring the ergs up. I like the example of bouncing a golf ball off of a snowbank or off of a white cement wall. If you have a good foundation of calcium, you're bouncing the golf ball off of a cement wall. It'll come back and hit you hard. If you try to bounce the golf ball off of a snowbank, it'll go right in there and it'll disappear and you won't see it. And that is why, in a high calcium situation, the foliar feeds will do a lot more, the nutrient drenches will do a lot more, everything will come back and hit you a lot harder. It won't take near as much as in this situation. And that makes it a lot easier and a lot cheaper.
Okay. Dwayne, can you cover the foliar spraying? What you started with, what you ended up with, what you're doing now? And I'm actually going to set the phone down and I'll be back in 1 minute while you cover on foliar spraying. And if you need to take a break afterwards, just let me know. Okay?
I get the point.
Okay, so just cover what you did from the beginning and all the way up to what you're doing now. And then when I come back in, I want to hear if there's any lessons learned. I want to get that and write those down, okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, what
Thank
we
you.
Started out with was foliar spraying with brick plaster to put more blossoms on. We didn't have blossoms. We needed blossoms. We needed more fruit. Brick Splaster is a spray that is a foliar spray that John has that really puts on blossoms. It really does. If this sounds kind of goofy, but if Brick Splaster does not put on blossoms, you've got another problem. What I'm saying is, never say never, never say always. Just after that ice storm, just after that 39 degrees in that greenhouse, just after that, Brick Splaster didn't work too well. Why not? Because the plants were extremely stressed from the cold temperatures, and so you have to take everything into account. Anyway, we sprayed with Brick Splaster when we came on down through there, and it works good. And then there's another product that's called Enthuse, and that works very, very well for plant stress. It's an excellent product to bring the bricks up in the plant and in the leaf. Yes, in the plant and in the fruit. And we have seen the bricks and the leaves go from, well, they were at 4, and then they went up to 11, and now he's foliar spraying with Enthuse, and we're getting the milk in there, and the bricks and the leaf is actually up to 15 right now. And,
okay, Dwayne, I'm back. Just keep going.
Okay, the big lesson that we got out of this was when he started foliar spraying with the Brick Splaster, he said, Dwayne, this stuff doesn't work. I said, oh, well, what's the problem? Well, it burns. And I was checking the bricks and leaves, and it doesn't really go up. The big lesson is don't put it on too thick. Do not put it on too thick. And there we come back to the sodium issue or the high ergs issue, high nitrates. If the ergs is very high, say 2,000 or 1,500 even, then the foliar sprays will burn the plant more readily. Now, how much should you put on? Well, how big are your plants? What are you using? What water are you using? There's a lot of questions like that. In my opinion, you should always use distilled water or rainwater or pond water for foliar feeding.
What about reverse osmosis water?
I have used that a little bit, but I prefer distilled. It just seems that it works better. It brings a better plant response. The big thing is make sure that the ergs in your water is under 50 that you use to foliar spray. That's the big thing. And so back to the amounts. In this 30 by 96 with 600 big plants in there, we're using slightly less than half a gallon, around half a gallon of liquid to foliar spray that greenhouse, and that's enough. And if you're going to do it more than once a day, cut the rate in half as far as the concentrate going into the water.
Okay, I think what you said then is is even if you got a recommendation, you have to be looking at the plants and cut it back if needed.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. You need to use your head for something else besides the hat rack.
Okay.
You need to watch the plants, and if something, I just had a call this morning from a greenhouse grower, and he said, Dwayne, one of the foliar sprays, it's not working. It doesn't work. I spray it on the plant, and this is small plants that he's starting. He said, I spray it on the plant, and they just droop down. It looks like they're going to die. It doesn't work. What should I do? I said, well, can you see on the leaf that you sprayed it? He said, oh, yeah. Yeah, we get it on there. I said, well, you're putting on too much. You're putting on too much. Use way, way, way less. You need to have the finest mist possible. Just let it drift down on the leaves. I like to hold the nozzle at least 2 foot away from the leaves. Just let it drift lightly down onto the leaves. You should not be able to see much moisture at all on that leaf.
In other words, you're almost making a do and just kind of letting it just kind of come to the plant that way. Not a do, a fog.
Well, what you want to do is just increase the mineral content in the air. That's the bottom line, really. But yeah, atomize it as fine as you can and just let it drift, just a fog. That's excellent. And then the hairs on the plant can pick that up out of the air just fine. And don't wet the leaf down with foliar sprays that are not intended to wet the leaf, or you'll have burning issues and so on.
Okay, so you primarily use Brix Blaster and Enthuse?
Yes.
And you use them separately or together?
Separately.
Okay, Brix Blaster is a foliar spray that promotes blossoms. It feeds the plant NPK calcium, but it is a strong energy to reproduce. Enthuse is a broad-spectrum trace mineral foliar spray. We've added quite a bit of trace minerals. It also includes some PGRs, some single amino acids, and I spike it with some of the things I know we need, such as selenium and iodine in very dilute quantities, to make sure we're bringing that up.
In my language, Enthuse is a vitamin B shot to the human. I don't know if there's any of that in there, but that's a good way to put it for the growers. It's just like a nutrient shot for the plant.
We'll get the other microphone. Hurry up. Okay.
And I was telling them, John, that right through that ice, or just after the ice storm, the Brix Blaster didn't work very well at opening flowers. So never say never, never say always. But generally speaking, Brix Blaster does a wonderful job at making a plant bloom.
Right. So you felt like the Enthuse did a good job there, though, of helping it through plant stress?
Big time, yes. Very much.
Okay, any lessons else besides, I've got Brix Blaster or any foliar sprays will not work if they're too concentrated, so be willing to cut back the concentration, reduce the amounts, make fine mist. The other thing is we found that distilled water works really good for foliar sprays. Otherwise, pond water, collected rainwater, try to keep it under 50 ergs. Any other lessons that are real takeaway lessons?
One thing I would like to mention is in the backpack sprayers, a lot of us use solos, and I just found out that the SP systems, it's SP on the back of the sprayer, will build up to 150 PSI. They have a more durable tip that can produce a finer mist, and it does a lot better job. As far as a backpack pump-up sprayer, I prefer the SP over the solo now. I thought Solo was the best.
So the SP, is that a brand? Is that a brand?
Yes, it's, well, yeah, I guess. It's SP Systems right on the back of that backpack blower. Where I find it is Ben Meadows or Forestry Supply or, you know, one of those companies, they sell it. I'm not sure if Gempler sells SP or not, but, yeah, that's a...
So you're saying that SP will have a higher velocity of spray and probably finer mist?
It will have a finer mist, definitely. definitely will, because it has a higher PSI, higher pressure. They use a different pump. It's a diaphragm with a piston in it. A diaphragm pump generally goes to 60 PSI, and the piston pumps generally go to 90. The way they describe it in the ad is that they have a diaphragm with a piston in it. So we can still do the powders and so on through the backpack, because with a diaphragm pump, the powders don't get down into the piston. So that works great. But this one goes to 150 PSI. I was just looking at that today. And my friend Jason has an SP, and I'm sure that will atomize it finer, will put out a finer fog than my solo backpack.
Okay, and now these SP sprayers, are they still, you're just hand pumping though, is that right?
That's right. It's hand pump, goes on your back, 3 to 4 gallons.
Wow, and still can get up to 150 PSI.
Yes.
Wow.
That's what the ad said. I'm going to buy one because my...
What kind of a tip is on there?
It's a brass or a copper tip, and you can just, it's adjustable. You just turn it for a fog or screw it out for a stream.
So the tip that comes with the SP sprayer would be fine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And see, the Solo just has a plastic, so I'm thinking, I'm glad I saw that, because that's what I'm going to get now.
Well, excellent. Well, it's, so you've basically, through the course of the beginning of the program, you started with some foliar sprays, and you have begun to, you increase the frequency. I imagine you covered that. Is that right?
I didn't. Yeah, that's correct. No, I didn't cover that very well. To start with, I was more concerned about getting the ergs up in the soil, because I knew that with low ergs, foliar feeding, here we go again. Never say never, never say always. But with low ergs, foliar feeding is generally a waste of time. But then again, it's not a waste of time, because the foliar feeding that you put on the plant goes down through the plant and into the roots and helps to build up the soil. But it's not a good way to build up the soil, because it's very slow, very difficult, very expensive. So foliar feeding, when the ergs is that low, generally does not bring visible return very fast at all. So when the ergs came up, say, to 400, 450, 500, we start increasing the frequency of the foliar sprays, and then you could see more response also.
Interesting.
So now we're foliar spraying every day in this one.
You're foliar spraying every day, and that's one time per day?
Pardon?
One time per day.
One time, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. He might occasionally do it twice, but basically we're aiming at once a day foliar spray, and the flowers are opening very nicely. The clusters are forming good. Another thing I want to point out is cracks. Everybody that grows tomatoes knows what cracks is in tomatoes. And when the ergs was that low, before January 12th, they had 50% or more cracked tomatoes. And now, well, actually, 2 weeks ago, we figured up what the percentage was, and it was down to 15%. Now, I don't know if it will improve that dramatically, you know, in other situations or not, but it was a huge improvement just by bringing the ergs up. Now, John, you explained that. We're sizing faster. We're growing faster, but it's not splitting as bad.
Okay. I'm going to theorize something, but I don't know if it's true. I'm going to look at the soil test to see if maybe they'll back me up. But one of the things is we are putting the marine in, which is a broad-spectrum trace mineral, and we're putting fish, which is broad-spectrum trace mineral from the oceans, and we're putting... Enfuse, which is broad spectrum foliar spray, and all that, we're adding a certain amount of copper, and copper helps to the plant to have the bark to stretch, so it can help to prevent splits. Were you putting any, specifically, any chelated copper in here?
We did once or twice.
Okay, so not frequently, though.
But not frequently, because on the soil test, the copper is showing high.
Okay, and I'm going to tell, when we began in January, the copper was showing 3.3. But when we look in March, it's showing 4.6 parts per million.
Mm-hmm. So we've seen some
increase here. Mm-hmm. And it's my recommendation that tomato ground, you want to have it in the upper threes to up to five parts per million on copper, because you want to prevent the cracks and the splits. And when I listened to Dr. Reams on some tapes, and his idea was when you got splits on tomatoes, check the copper, and you're probably going to need to add some. And
I got another.
Go ahead.
I got another lesson here. Don't leave the water on overnight.
Okay. Big lesson.
Yeah, he had 6 inches of water in that greenhouse, and the herbs were up around 600, staying up there 600, 650, 580, and then we all make mistakes, but anyway, he forgot the water and left it on overnight, and it dropped down 450, then 400, then 350, and we immediately started putting in more products, more of the different things, you know, and adding some different. I added in some more potassium. I added in a little phosphorus. And then today it's back up to 650. So we got over that one okay.
Okay, so what's your goal right now as you look at the tomatoes and the blossoms and the bricks of the leaves? What's your goal for ergs as you're trying to stabilize at this point where you're producing heavily, you have a lot of tomato that you're filling, plus you're still putting on new blossoms?
Right now, with this guy's water, which his water has 170 or 200 herbs, something like that, my goal is 700.
Okay, so you would like to keep it around 700?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's with water at around 200. Mm-hmm. And they do very nicely there.
Okay. So just a couple things that I recall. If you kind of monitor the bricks, reading of the leaves, if you see a sudden drop, what's that mean to you?
Well, you messed up somewhere. And it means, if you see, let's see, okay, you said if you see a sudden drop in the bricks.
Let's say you're at 11 bricks and you suddenly went down to 600.
Well,
sorry,
monitor.
11 to 6.
If you're monitoring your herbs, you'll probably see it in the herbs as quickly as you'll see it in the leaf, or a little quicker. There's any number of situations that could cause that, but what that means is that the plant is no longer making new cells at the rate that you want it to make new cells, or it's not producing healthy cells, because of leaf is the sugar factory for the plant. That's where it synthesizes its protein. And so you have to go back and you say, okay, the bricks in the leaf is dropping. That means the sugars in the leaf is dropping. That means the photosynthesis is not happening as it should. That means, and you just need to keep on going back and going back and using deductive thought and go over your records. What did we do different? What happened? There's no one thing, John, that I can put my finger on and say, okay, that's what it is.
Okay. One of the things I would say is look at the crop and see, are you going through a phase change in the crop physiology? Are you suddenly having a higher demand because maybe it's filling, you know, if you go from just putting on little ones to filling bigger ones and plus putting on new clusters, that's a big change. And so it might be a possibility to see if maybe you have to raise your base level of herbs.
Okay, that's a good point. I was going to say you could probably see that in the herbs, but you're saying if you go through a change, you might have to raise the base level.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So if you're watching the leaves and, you know, let's say you're keeping your herbs at 400 and all of a sudden your leaves drop from 11 to 6, probably raise, you know, my first thing is raise your ergs up a little higher and keep it maybe, try keeping it at 550 and see what it does, and the leaves might come right back up.
Mm-hmm. Well, generally you will see that in the ergs anyhow, because the ergs isn't going to sit there. If you take the ergs every day, you will detect that in the ergs when it starts.
Mm-hmm.
You will. When it starts forming seed, when it starts to fill fruit, any of those changes, you can detect them. The ergs tells you so much. It's amazing. It's really amazing.
Okay, I have a couple questions. What happens when the conductivity of the pH is too high? How do we manage it to get it back down into the optimum range?
In the soil?
Yeah, so the ergs, the ECB, electrical conductivity, so ergs and pH gets high.
Both?
Yes.
At the same time?
Yeah.
Well, what's soil test say? That would be the first thing. It depends on where the ergs is coming from. That brings to mind, of course, greenhouse in Iowa, where the ergs was way high. And it was a low calcium situation. So we did add calcium in the form of micronized lime. Sometimes that can just turn into a tiger, and you've got to hold the end of the tail, and that tiger weighs a ton. Sometimes it can turn into that, and there's not a whole lot you can do except try to ride it out and stay on your feet.
So in other words, we could do some fertigation of the micronized lime, and that program with no soluble nutrients really, but try to get some more available calcium there.
The number one thing is don't put on more of what you have enough of. That's number one. It's so simple and so basic. Don't put on more of what you have adequately already. Don't do it.
Now, did Daniel Beachy Strawberries, did he have a situation with high ergs and high pH and we were fertigating?
He had a very high ergs.
And I thought it was kind of a little bit higher pH too.
I'll grab the file here.
Okay.
But what I'm saying is if you have a high ergs, you have high levels of nutrients, sometimes you really can't do a whole lot about it except sometimes you can water. That's one thing you can do. Use low conductivity water. And if you have a soil that percolates well, you're lucky, and just water it and just flood it.
This would be a lot easier. It would be a lot easier to do that if you didn't have plants. You could just really do a heavy washing of the water and maybe drop some of the ergs that way.
Yes, if you have plants, then you get watery crop. And I'm trying to find here. There's strawberries. Yeah, we had a 7.0 on the pH. We had 2,600 on the ergs. We had 700 on the calcium, 3,200 on potassium, and 2,800 on the phosphorus. That was a situation where we had high ergs, a 7 on the pH, not too high, but it's high. And we did flush that one. We did flush it with water. We tried that. We had extremely low calcium at 700 pounds, so we fed it micronized lime to try to get a crop that was halfway decent, because we knew you can grow plants with... Oh, here's another thing. The nitrates were 250, and the sodium was very high at 72. So how much that was adding to that 2,600 on the ergs, I don't know. Probably a lot. To try to get a crop, we knew we had to have calcium in that cell. Go back to that cell. We knew we had to have calcium in there, so we added micronized lime, and that helped to buffer some of those high levels of elements. It helped to buffer those so the damage to the plant was less, and it gave us a calcium source, and we also put in bugs and sugar and so on to break down that calcium, so it gave us a calcium source so that we could get calcium into those cells, and we wound up getting a fair decent crop off of there. I guess it wasn't nothing outstanding, but it was better than nothing. So,
from what I remember, he was pretty happy about the crop that he did get.
Yeah, yeah. The year before, he had 200 pints, and this year was around 2,000 pints, something like that. Same greenhouse. He had a little bit more plants, maybe the second year, but not much, not that much more. And the bricks on his strawberries, he had 7s to 9s, I believe, in that range. I think 9 was about the highest he got out of that greenhouse.
Okay. Well, that's interesting that he was able to get some production anyway and use some calcium in that.
And the other thing to those people who don't know about this situation, that greenhouse was put up over an old farmyard or a barnyard. So don't put your greenhouses on old barnyards.
Okay, that's we hear it twice.
Well, that's like me. I need to hear it more than once.
Well, that's good. When I was gone, did you cover much on the use of milk going through the drip lines?
Not much.
Okay. Do you feel like that's a valuable thing or tool?
I think it can be. From what we're seeing, I think it can be. We're seeing that it will help size the tomatoes very rapidly or faster than. And here we go again. Never say never, never say always. But our experience here is that it's helping the tomatoes to size, and it's bringing the bricks and the leaf up. Those leaves will just thicken. It's a very nice source of calcium and also phosphorus, and it will thicken those leaves. The bricks in the leaf is up to 15, and I attribute it some to the milk. We did pick up on the frequency of the foliar spraying, but I think the milk is doing some good things. And we are just using store milk, pasteurized, homogenized, and so on.
Okay, what kind? Whole milk, 2% skim?
I don't even know.
Okay.
I don't even know. I just told him to get some milk.
Okay, and I want to make a point that the milk always goes in fertigation number one, which is the growth side of things. There's way too many acids and problems that could coagulate and plug up some things in fertigation number two. So always keep that on the growth side.
Mm-hmm. And another thing is that we're putting in a little bit of vinegar. And when you're putting in micronized lime, that's a good thing, but you can overdo it easily, and that's why it's important to monitor your pH.
Okay, vinegar goes in fertigation number two.
Right, that goes with the reproductive side.
Okay.
And here's a very interesting thing. We were having pHs down close to 5. And so sometimes you have to fight fire with fire. So we started putting in 1 ounce of vinegar into this greenhouse in fertigation number two, and that pH jumped up. It came up by adding that vinegar. In other words, we were solubilizing more of that micronized lime. This is a theory. Solubilizing more of that micronized lime, and the pH was coming up. We were creating a greater level of resistance, so we had more energy because there was more resistance to the flow.
Okay. So then are you continuing that then with the... Okay, and are you using apple cider vinegar?
Yes.
Okay. So looking here at your current more recent level of urge, you're in the 500 and 600 range, and then sometimes dropping down into the 400s.
So that was because of the overwatering.
The overwatering, okay. All right. So you think that you can get it back up in the 600s and maybe push it up to your ideal that you're looking at with 700?
Mm-hmm. It was 650 this morning.
Okay. And you are putting out some additional nitrogen besides the fish in the form of ammonium sulfate and maybe sometimes urea, or did you drop urea?
No, we're using urea
because
of the pH issue. Ammonium sulfate drives the pH down. Urea drives it up. And so we were alternating. Now, urea doesn't have quite the kick that ammonium sulfate does. In other words, it will not push the ergs as high has ammonium sulfate will. And urea is 46% nitrogen, ammonium sulfate is 21.2% nitrogen. So if you do urea, cut the rate in half from ammonium sulfate. Don't overdo that. But we're going back and forth because our pH is running down around 5, and we don't want it to go below that really. The plants are doing fine, so we're not having any bad effects. But we go in there with urea, and then we see the pH come up a little bit. The herbs go down a little bit. We go back in there with ammonium sulfate. The herbs come back up. The pH goes back down. We're just... We're walking a tightrope across Niagara Falls. We're playing this thing just as hard as we can play it to get production out of there that we can, so that they can get their money out of this thing.
Okay, let's bring that up. Are they making money now, or is it worthwhile for them to follow this program?
Yes. Yes, they weren't making anything. They said they weren't making anything. And so anything's better than that, but yes, at 500 pounds of tomatoes a week, and they sell them local here for $3 a pound, and then the excess they were taking to a produce auction, and they were getting, I think they got $1.50, maybe, something like that, I'm not sure, but it wasn't nearly as much as they got locally. And they're working on local markets to sell more here locally, because obviously the price is better than at the auction. But yes, they are making money.
Okay, well, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about how, after following this program a little bit, we feel like the potassium has begun to slip, and then we have had to address potassium. And what do you look for signs for a shortage of potassium?
Well, this is thanks to David Yoder. We were seeing a lot of the cluster branches breaking or kinking. And the tomatoes do size very rapidly when you have the herbs at 600-700, the bricks and the leaves at 11 and 12 and above. The tomatoes size much faster than when the bricks and the leaf is at 6. And the herbs is at 400. I just blamed it on that. I thought we were sizing tomatoes very quickly, and they need to get those clusters tied up. David Yoder told me that he almost never ties his clusters up. Doesn't need to. They don't break down. And he said that's a potassium issue. And so our last test came back, potassium at 257. Is that correct?
Let's see. The most recent 200. One was, 200.
200.
Yeah, so that's getting really pretty low in a greenhouse. That's low.
Mm-hmm. And so we're starting to put in some soluble, high pH potassium. And we just started that 3-4 days ago, so it's too early to tell what that will do as far as helping to increase the strength of those cluster stems.
So watch clusters bending over as a potassium shortage.
I would say so. Mm-hmm. That's what David told me, and it makes sense to me, because potassium is what holds the fruit onto the plant. So we're not actually talking about the attachment of the tomato to the plant. We're talking about the branch coming out the tomatoes. But potassium also determines the caliber of the stem. So, I think it's a good theory.
Well, I know there's been some problems. Some people can, I've heard some stories of people getting real excited about micronized limestone and fertigating, and potassium was not addressed, and it was definitely to the detriment of crop yield and crop quality. So, we don't want to emphasize calcium to the point of excluding potassium.
That brings up another point. If your nutrients are way out of whack on your soil test, you can have adequate levels or excessive levels of this or that, and you can come up with a potassium shortage for the plant in some situations. Mm. And in this situation, we had a extreme nitrogen shortage. And all the elements go into the plant, phosphate form except nitrogen. And nitrogen can take up potassium. So generally, when you're high in potassium, you're going to have plenty of it, because usually you have plenty of nitrogen to take it into the plant. Well, if you're extremely low on nitrogen, nitrate nitrogen specifically, and ammonia nitrogen, I don't know if it makes a difference there, but your potassium uptake is not going to be happening with nitrogen. So you could, you know, if you have a problem with nutrient uptake, which we did, I'm just saying the potassium levels on the first test was 400 and something, that doesn't mean that we had enough in the plant. And yeah, I can hear you say, well, do a tissue analysis. Well, we have done, no, we haven't done any tissue analysis on this one. But that doesn't always tell the whole story. I'd rather go with a soil test and a conductivity meter any day than with a tissue analysis. I think a guy can raise a lot better crops with a good soil test, conductivity meter, and a pH meter than with a tissue analysis.
Yeah, and you probably want to throw in a Brix meter there to keep checking the leaves and stuff like that once in a while.
Very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Definitely.
Well, that's been a lot of things that we learned. I'm really very appreciative for this interaction with you and you with Gary on there, because we've all been learning, and that's really the purpose of this call, is to try to see if we can get some points clear about this thing and get some principles down on papers to think about. Do you have anything you would like to add, Dwayne, on different things, the overall ideas?
Yes.
Okay.
On the overall idea, don't take any one thing and run with it. It's not the way it works. You have to have everything working together. That's one last thought I would like to give. Do not run with any one thing. You have to have the soil test, you have to have the conductivity, you have to have the pH, you have to have the lime, you have to have the nitrogen, you have to have potassium. Don't take any one thing and hold it up and say, this is what we need, we're going. You need to figure out what you need, where you are, why you need it, how much you need, and then use it. And sometimes you have to do a little bit of experimenting and hope you're on the right track.
Yes. You know, and I would say this. Don't take the soil test and the recommendations and follow just that.
That's right.
I mean, that is only a snapshot in time. So you've got to, the farmer, the grower, has to be monitoring daily, especially in the greenhouse, and adjusting. Because, in making recommendations, we can only give a suggested or a beginning. So the tomatoes might be, pre-bloom when I get the soil test and I make a recommendation. But the situations change, and so you've got to be able to adapt with that crop.
I'm glad you brought that up. Don't take the recommendations as a hard, fast rule. It's a good foundation. It's excellent foundation. But then when you get into the solubles, there's no way to forecast everything that's going to happen. What if you overwater? Then you need to put in more to bring the herbs back up. What if, you know? So that's a very good point.
I think I'm writing that down as a real takeaway, is that you have to add to it. And you can start with that, but then monitor and adjust.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, any thoughts on what would you think of trying to do this whole thing organically for a few people that may be growing this organically? Any thoughts on that?
Well, it's kind of like taking a canoe trip up to Missouri. Doing it this way, and now when I say conventional, I'm not talking about chemicals or spraying chemicals. We're working with it as hard as we can to do everything we can to get the nutrition up in the plant, in the fruit that we eat. That's the goal. That's the bottom line. Okay, so doing it this way, and we're taking a canoe trip up to Missouri. We've got two guys in the canoe, Two strong guys, and both have a good paddle. And we're heading up the Missouri. You know, going upstream, we're going pretty good. Now, if we want to go organic, only one guy has a paddle, and one of his arms are tied behind his back. We might get there, but boy, it's going to be hard work. That's kind of my thought on it. Now, that might be exaggerated for clarity, but can it be done? Yeah. That also depends on where you're starting from. If you have a nice situation to start from, if you have enough phosphorus, if you have enough, you know, then it might be a piece of cake. Now, thinking about this situation that we just covered tonight, trying to do this organically, no, I don't think so, you know. So it depends on where you're starting from.
Okay, well, that's a good point. I really appreciate your point. David Allen, are you online? Can you speak? I gave him the access. Okay. Well,
can he just push *6 or something like that?
Yeah, he might have muted himself. I don't know. But *6, if he didn't call him with the organizer, I just want him to see if he had a few words to say. If he does, fine. We'll just go in for a few more minutes, and then if he does not, we're going to call it a night.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, well, I think, you know, we didn't cover greenhouse number 2, but I think that's fine. We got the major principles out of greenhouse number 1.
Mm-hmm.
One thing, I guess, Wendell was there with Dr. Scow and I one time, and a few other things that we noticed. Wendell noticed that if you're going to be planting these tomatoes that are going to hang down from the greenhouse like these are, and they're hanging on the tie-up thing, it would probably be good to plant the tomato at an angle so that when you have to lower the tomato plants, there's not a breaking at the base of the plant. So that would be another one, is plant it at about a 45-degree angle in the direction that, so you can start to wrap that around without causing a big break or a kink, basically, at the root. The other thing to note was that these are all hybrid tomatoes, as far as I am aware, and so maybe as we get the soil right, we might be able to experiment with a plant or two that are not hybrids and see what we get with bricks. So, but we, in everything we're talking about tonight, we were talking about hybrid tomatoes. Can you confirm that?
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Another thing that you have to be careful about is your water quality. That can be a big issue.
It is my conclusion that long-term, we have discussed, and long-term, it's probably good to get a system that cleans up the water, even for the fertigation. Maybe putting in some kind of a system, maybe RO or something that will clean it up, especially if you have a little higher conductivity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's all I got. And we're going to hang this up. I want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll try to get this made available. I'd also like to offer people, I'll try to get a copy of all of these takeaway points and put that up as a download, or if you're not doing internet, if you want to call the office after about a week or so, we can probably have that available. We can mail it out. Just some of the takeaway points from this. And again, thank you, and thank you, Dwayne, and especially give our thanks to Gary and Eldon for their willingness to share and let this be talked about.
Well, thanks a lot, John, and I hope it was a help. I hope it can help people to better monitor and to better produce better crops.
Okay. And I guess with that, we'll say God bless and good night.
Good night, John.
Take care. Bye.
You can't run, for instance, you can't put micronized lime in with 511 fish, or I mean, excuse me, the dram fish, the 2.5 high phos fish. I had a farmer put those two together last fall, and his nurse tank boiled over. It cooked over the top, and he lost about 200 gallons of his mixture. So that's why you can't put those two together. You have to do them separately.
So maybe another lesson maybe out of all this is when you're first starting off, you may want to have a good consultant to guide you through some of this. Would you agree with that as a pretty good lesson?
Yes, yes. Often the farmer is, what shall I say, you know, he can't really see what he needs to see. It helps to get an outside eyes in, or somebody that hasn't been working in here every day to come in, take a look at it, and pass opinion on it.
So we need some outside eyes, and some just so you people have seen it all the time, they can get some help from a consultant to understand some of the range principles.
Yes. I sure like to do that on my own. I like to get outside opinions, and it really helps. You need to do it. You really need to do it.
I agree. We got a question here that came in. How does sodium affect the ERG's requirements? So if, let's say that instead of having low sodium, what if it was higher sodium in the greenhouse? What would we be doing for the ERG's, for the base levels?
Well, what sodium does is pushes the number higher on the meter. That is simply, I mean, for the language that as farmers can understand, or as produce growers can understand, it pushes the number higher on the meter and does nothing for the plant. Now, one of my sayings is never say never and never say always. So when I say something, it does nothing for the plant. Sometimes it might do something for the plant, but for all practical purposes, it's not helping us by putting a higher number on the meter. Therefore, it's very important to know what that sodium level is, so you know if I go in, for instance, I'd have gone into this greenhouse. Plants are 12 feet tall. They're dying off at the bottom. No tomatoes. No flowers. The bumblebees can't live in there because there's no flowers to pollinate and whatever. And that ERG's reading would have come up 450. I would have known that there is something in there that's pushing the number high on the meter that is not contributing to the plant's health. And so you do have to take that in consideration. I would have done the same thing. I would have established a baseline. Okay, I've got a reading of 450 and nothing's happening. That means we have to go up. There's only one way to go. Sodium can help. Well, you know, it can help in the taste, but it's a minor. And the other big lesson I got out of this is, and this one is a really big lesson. You have to realize that all growth, all formation of matter is the creation of new cells. And that sounds simple in the extreme. But if you're not creating more fruit, if you don't have growth, you're not forming new cells. Okay, so what about it? Well, this is what about it. Nitrogen is the number one element it takes to form a new cell. So if you're not forming new cells, you probably have a nitrogen problem. Not probably, you have a nitrogen problem. I'm not saying that in every time you're going to be low, but I'm going to say you're going to have a nitrogen problem. That was a huge lesson for me. Anytime you look at any plant and it's not growing, then you don't have new cell formation. And that you need to think about that, and really think about that, because then you start to see this picture that you have to create new cells, and then you need to know how to create new cells, and that's where you guys up at International Ag Labs helped me so much to understand what elements it takes to form new cells. Then you can start putting in what you need and go from there. It's all about life at the cellular level. Maybe I'm getting a little bit ahead, but I sure wanted to bring that out.
Well, I wrote it down because I've got a whole list of lessons learned, and I've already got six of them so far.
That's the most important one that I saw out of this whole thing. Now, back to that sodium issue. So, if you have 450 on the ergs, and you're still not making new cells, then your energy on that meter is registering is a false, or it's not usable by the plant to create new cells. So we have to go on top of that with the correct elements to start forming more new cells.
So that can come from sodium as well as high conductivity water.
It can, and it can come from nitrate. And nitrates in and of itself, they'll push a plant growth if you have potassium there, but sometimes, I learned this lesson last year, I had a grower with high nitrates in his water. It really didn't push huge, lush plant growth like you'd expect from a high nitrogen situation, but it pushed the ergs extremely high in his soil in the greenhouse. And
it didn't grow very well?
Not very well. Not very well. He got a crop, but it wasn't a very good one. It was a struggle. And so he had his water tested, and now he found out that there's high nitrates, so that now it all falls together. That's why we were getting high ergs readings, and the plants weren't doing very well. So in that greenhouse, we had to establish a baseline on the meter of about 800. When it came down to 600, we had to start fertilizing, or the plants just stopped.
Okay. Now, would you say that this is why it's critically important to get a soil test, and so you know your baseline on your sodium and some of the other elements like the nitrogen and phosphorus, potassium, calcium? Those are some really key things.
Exactly. Without a good soil test, you're still out there hunting for mosquitoes in the dark of the moon with a blindfold over your eyes with a fly swatter.
Well, where I come from, northern Minnesota, you just go outside and they got you.
Well, I mean, trying to hit one with a fly swatter, maybe they're so thick you can just take a swipe at it.
What you do is you cover your mouth so you don't breathe them in.
Okay, well, that wasn't a good analogy, but anyway, you're lost without a good soil test, because there's no way to know your sodium levels, your nitrate levels, your potassium levels, your phosphorus levels. All of those play into that ergs thing.
Really, so in other words, how you manipulate the conductivity, the way you, what ingredients you use, you go back to the soil test to determine where the weak points are and try to hit those as well as bringing the ergs up.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Because if you try to push the ergs, say you have high potassium and high nitrate to start with, and if you go in there with a high nitrate, high potassium product, you will probably push the ergs up some, but you'll just get a plant that the health of the plant will simply go down very fast if you put on what is there in excess already. That is one good way to bring the health of the plant down.
Okay, so let's carry forward this story now. We started having some initial success. You saw blossoms, and then you started struggling as the tomato was filling the new tomatoes. You were struggling with the ergs.
Mm-hmm.
What were you doing then to try to overcome that?
Well, when we got the soil test back, we were looking at a calcium level of around 1,000. We were looking at nitrates around 40. Ammonia, I believe, was at 4. Potassium and phosphorus were both a little high, 400, 500, 600, something like that. And so we thought, okay, what can we do? We really don't want to add nitrates, which I did a little bit of that initially. We really don't want to add potassium or phosphorus. We're very short on calcium, and we're very short on ammonium nitrogen, ammoniacal nitrogen, ammonia nitrogen. So the first thing we did is starting adding micronized lime through the drip line. And that supplies calcium when it solubilizes. But to solubilize that, you have to have microbes, you have to have sugars, you have to have life there in the soil. And to have life in the soil, you have to have ergs in the soil. And lime by itself does not raise the ergs a whole lot. And it didn't. So we needed something to play against that lime so we could raise the ergs more. And so we started, of course we started foliar feeding at the same time. And so we went in there with some ammonium sulfate, which is ammonia, nitrogen, and sulfates. And the sulfates are acidic, so they bring the pH down. And so we started bouncing that off the lime, so to speak, or working it against the lime. We fertigated the lime in the morning, and the bugs, and the sugar, and so on. And then in the evening, we would put in ammonium sulfate. We put in a little bit of phosphorus even. The test was actually, I don't have the most recent test. Well, this is the most recent. I don't have the
first one. I have the first one, Dwayne.
What's the first one on the phosphorus?
It was 421, and then potassium was 377.
Okay, on the first one.
Yep.
So we had 421 on phosphorus, but we went ahead and added a little bit anyhow, just to try to get the ergs up, because we needed something soluble to get the ergs up.
You know, one of the things you may want to point out, when you're having such a high level of density of tomato plants, and they're 10 foot tall, and some of the rules of, you know, only maybe 200 pounds of phosphorus and potassium, that is such a little buffering that in greenhouses that are this intense,
I shouldn't have called
it
that.
It should be
high.
A little higher.
Yeah.
Oops. Okay, that? I'm still here. You're there. So, you there, Dwayne?
Hello.
Okay, Dwayne, can you hear me?
Are you there, John?
I can hear you. Can you hear me, Dwayne? Okay. Looks like Dwayne got cut off. I'm going to look at a couple questions here. Roger had a question on what is the bricks of the tomatoes now? And we're going to cover that, but we started with two bricks tomatoes, which is the lowest I've ever heard of a tomato. And then through the course of time, it moved up to two to four bricks. And
see if John comes back on.
I'm back here. I'm here, Dwayne. Can anybody hear me? If you can, could somebody email me at Soil Restorer? Okay, thank you, Michael. I'm glad you sent me the email. Somebody can hear me. Okay, I'm gonna just gonna keep on talking a little bit, I'm gonna cover some of the questions. Thanks, David. I got your message. Dwayne, are you there? Okay.
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, you're back. Hey, great.
Yep. Called.
I don't know what happened, but. Okay, somebody want to email if you can hear both Dwayne and I. Everybody can hear, seems like they can hear me.
Okay. I had a call or two, people could hear me and they could hear you, but we couldn't hear each other.
Yeah, I could hear you, but you couldn't hear me.
No, I couldn't hear a thing, so I just
Okay. Alright, so you were talking about, well, I can't even remember what you were talking about now.
Okay, we started talking about what we started adding in and why we started adding it in.
Okay, what you were doing to get the conductivity up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And I don't know how detailed you want to be, but basically what we did was pushed the, okay, we need to say that nitrate nitrogen pushes growth. Ammonia nitrogen produces seed. We did not need more growth. We needed more seed. We needed more fruit. And so we started putting ammonium sulfate in there. We started
So you took all nitrates out?
Yes, all.
Okay. That's an important thing.
Mm-hmm. All nitrates, because we had sufficient growth.
Okay.
And so we put 5-1-1 fish in there.
Okay.
And describe what that is, John. Well, we did want, no? Yeah, describe.
Well, that's an ocean fish that is, they take the oil out, and then they leave the meat on, and it's basically cooked and ground real fine, and then it's basically dehydrated down to a pretty low level of moisture, so it's about 50% solids. It's got sulfuric acid, so there's a lot of trace minerals, and so the meat then, of course, makes the nitrogen high as a 5-1-1. So it's an excellent fish for high nitrogen and amino acid form of nitrogen, too.
Yes, it's not just hard chemical nitrogen. And that is actually when we started seeing the ergs come up and stabilize. They crept up to 400, 450, 425, then on up to 460, and then to 500.
Did you say then you were using both ammonium sulfate and fish?
Both.
Really? What quantities were you using?
We used a quart of 5-1-1 fish, and we used 16 ounces of ammonium sulfate.
For that greenhouse?
Every day, and the PM. In the AM, we were putting on the limestone and the bugs and the sugar and the liquid humates and so on. And then the PM, we were putting on the reproductive growth.
And I might add that we still had the sugar and some another bug package in the second fertigation.
Yes, and
some humates.
We don't want to overemphasize one thing or the other. Without the bugs, without the sugar, without the humates, I don't think this would have worked. We're kind of hitting the high points and saying, okay, we needed nitrogen. And that is a high point, and it's a very important one. But I'm glad you brought that out. Without sugar and without bugs, it doesn't work either, or not nearly as good.
Okay. And were you, in the second fertigation, were you also putting micronized ream in, broad-spectrum rock powder, or not at this point?
Yes.
Okay, then I'll describe that, too, because it's just one of the things that we were doing. Micronized ream in is a broad-spectrum, finely ground rock powder, and it'd be kind of in the same family, similar to azomite, if people know what that is. So that was going in. What rates were you using that in?
I believe that was 2 tablespoons.
Okay, and how much micronized limestone were you putting in?
We started out with 2 tablespoons. No, 2 teaspoons. We started out with 2 teaspoons. And that is 0.4 of an ounce. Yeah, we started out with 2 teaspoons. Today we're putting in 4 tablespoons of micronized lime. Just to try to, and now the issue is, with all the sulfates and with everything going in, and probably the bugs in the soil starting to work very well, the pH dropped from, we started at 7.8, and now it's running down around 5. And
okay.
So we bumped up the calcium to try to bring the pH back up, to create more resistance, and therefore we gain more energy.
Okay, I think what I hear you saying is another lesson, that intensive production in a greenhouse requires intensive monitoring. Would you agree?
Absolutely.
And so you're monitoring how frequently?
Daily.
And what were you checking every day?
We were checking the ergs, the pH, and the ORP every day. Now, the ORP, you can explain that, John, if you want to. That doesn't seem to, with this program, it seems that if you keep the herbs where it needs to be, if you put in what needs to be put in, the ORP kind of takes care of itself.
I would agree that from what we're seeing, that we don't really need to monitor the ORP, but we were experimenting. We thought maybe because it's under plastic, it might need it. Our conclusion at this point is it's not a big issue at this point. Better to go with the pH and the herbs, and that, and if we just follow that based on what we see with the soil test, we're probably going to be okay. Okay, so you're monitoring every day. That's mm-hmm. a huge lesson. I mean, people don't think necessarily that they need to monitor that
and
every day.
And you don't have to. You don't have to. But then your production will not be... You get out of it what you put into it. That's the thing. And if you want... And this was a very difficult situation to jump in there right in the middle where there wasn't anything happening, and you had these plants that were 12 foot tall. It was almost like having a fleet of race cars all ready to go, and you brought a 55-gallon drum of gasoline in the back of your truck to fuel them all up. You couldn't keep up hauling fuel. That was about what it was like.
Do you realize a quart per day is 10 gallons an acre daily on liquid fish? Are you really sure you needed that much? I'm quizzing you. I'm taking the other side here. Just curious.
Well, all I can say is it's working. That's what I can say. The bricks and the leaves on January 12th, the bricks and the leaves were around 4 to 5.
Okay, I mentioned in the email 6, so I was wrong. So 4 to 5 was the bricks and the leaves.
It was hard, yeah. They were struggling to keep it at that level. That's the way I understood them anyway. And by February 28th, the bricks and the leaves was up to 11. So I'm not going to argue.
Okay. So the results are speaking for themselves. So we started with the bricks in the tomatoes. Chart now what do we got with tomato bricks and starting with what we the very beginning ones and then where we're at now. Bring it up to now.
The bricks to start with was 2 and under. 2 was about the highest they could find, and now we have some. We tested one here at home that was 6.1, and that's the highest one I tested. What we have now, and I picked the little bitty ones that don't sell, and it's interesting those little things that get kicked aside because they don't look as pretty, don't taste as good either.
Really,
they are the tail enders. Yeah.
Really. Now, did
There's
you
a reason
have you...
why a number one tomato is called a number one tomato.
Hmm. Have you checked now the larger size tomato to see just what the bricks is on those recently?
Yes. Gary gave me a yellow one just recently, a large, nice one. It's one of the yellow, one of the yellows there at the back end of the greenhouse, and that was 6.1, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it tasted better than the smaller ones that were...
Oh, yeah, 4.9, yeah, you can taste the difference from 4.9.
Oh, so you had a 4.9 on some of the smaller ones.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the bigger ones were 6.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so we kept on doing that, and well, then we got hit with an ice storm. What was it, the end of February? Let's see. No. Let me see. When did we have the meeting up here in Branson?
February 25th, 6th, 7th. And so I saw the greenhouse on the 24th.
We got hit with an ice storm about the 6th and 7th and somewhere in that area of February. And the electricity went off. It went down to 39 degrees in there. And so we had a huge setback as far as yield. The flowers aborted because of the cold temperature, I guess. It took us almost 3 weeks, a little over 2 weeks, to get the flowers opening back up nice and white and yellow. It took almost 3 weeks to get it going again real good. So right now we are harvesting that slump. Right now the harvest isn't too great because of that ice storm in February. But in... the 25th of March, no, the 18th of March, the pH was going down a little under 5, and that's where you brought up the idea of putting in some milk. And so we started putting in some milk. And the pH did come up. It came up 5.3, 5.7, 5.0, 5.1. And what we saw by putting in that milk was that the tomatoes sized more rapidly and the bricks in the leaves came up further. And now we have a 15 bricks in the leaf. And actually, John, we're right in that harvesting slump, so I don't really have a nice big red tomato bricks right now. There's some ripening.
So you're harvesting the tomatoes that were put on during that slump and the time that they were behind.
Yes.
Okay. I got a question here I just want to cover. David was curious about the phosphates on the greenhouse number one that we're talking about. On January 20th, which is, Dwayne must have taken this, maybe the 12th or 14th or somewhere around there.
12.
But 12. Okay, we had 421 pounds of phosphates and 377 pounds of potassium and 1,000 pounds of calcium, 1,063. And then fast forward, and do you want me to just give the numbers for the next soil test, Dwayne?
Sure.
Okay, in our lab we got it on the 20th of March, so it must have been pulled a little bit before that. And the phosphorus has dropped to 257, and the potassium dropped to 200. And the calcium dropped a whopping big loss down to 542.
So the phosphorus and potassium both dropped 200 points, right?
Basically, yes. 177 on the potassium. But the calcium went from 1,000 to 500, so it dropped significantly. And the pH is, it's down to a 6.1. So the
actually,
pH
we're
is,
getting lower readings than that in the
you're getting lower readings, yeah. Yeah, I wonder if sitting in that, going through the lab and stuff, maybe without roots pulling on it, maybe it had a tendency to kind of come back up a little bit. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that, but I'm just speculating out loud.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a big drop, but in the meantime, we're seeing quite a bit of production from the very first test in. Basically, it's 2 months on our soil test. It's 2 months to the day. We had nothing. Then we had quite a bit of production after we had a bunch of blossoms put on, and now we're going through a little bit of a lull because of that big frost. A cold spell that went through the greenhouse.
We had an ice storm and electricity went off, so the heat went off. But I was in there today, and there's now the first big clusters that came on after the ice storm are ripening now, and there's five clusters above that, or four clusters above that, five total average on every plant, and they're just loaded. They're really loaded, and they're sizing fast. So it looks good. It looks like the production will jump way back up again.
Okay. So what is the production on the 3,000 square foot? What are you seeing a few weeks before that was slowed down because of the ice storm consequences?
They picked 500 pounds out of there in a week.
500 pounds.
Mm-hmm. What amazing.
Okay.
That's not so big, you know. You growers that harvest more than that, you're thinking, oh, that's not that much. But what we have to remember here is we have a plant that was almost dead, that the bricks on the leaf was 4, that the bricks on the fruit was 2, and they weren't doing anything. And now, to pick it up that much, those plants have the ability to do that much just by increasing the energy with the correct nutrients based on the soil test. I think it's phenomenal. And I think they will see higher yields than that if they keep on doing this thing, you know, and pushing these plants. It looks good in there.
Okay, I want to clean up just a couple questions here. Is the 511 fish levels okay with organic certification? The fish itself is fine for organic certification. I don't know if they say how much nitrogen can be applied per area. If they do, I'm sure we're way over. But the soil required it, and the density of the plants required it in order to keep the energy up. So we'd have to check with certification. But if that was not kept up, I'm very positive that the ergs would have really gone down. The plants would not have been able to add on new clusters of blossoms, and the leaves, the bricks of the leaves, would definitely have gone down because the energy has not been kept up. Next question, Roger, were you measuring the soil or pHs and ergs? We were doing everything with the soil. We were not measuring leaf pH or energy, and maybe you did, but it wasn't showing up on what's your sheets here that you keep records of.
No, we didn't.
Okay, and so this leads up to one other thing I just mentioned, keeping records. One of the most important things to do when you're making all of going through this whole process is keep a detailed sheet of records of what was the things. So Dwayne and Gary and did. They have date, time, the ergs, the pH, they have ORP, but I think we can skip that, and then what was applied. And do this every day, and so that you'll go back and be able to learn a whole lot just by watching what was done in the past. Would you agree with that, Dwayne?
Absolutely. Records are extremely valuable as an educational tool. Extremely so.
Yeah,
the other thing I want to mention is I don't want anybody to jump on that micronized lime thing and run with it. We're putting on the equivalent now of 10 pounds per acre per day, the equivalent. That is not something you want to try in strawberries or in other plants. Tomatoes planted in this density will handle that, and they'll thrive on it, but be careful and don't take that and just run with it and put it on anything. I wanted to bring that up.
Yes. This is intensive production on a low calcium soil, and we're watching the soil test as well. So you got a good warning.
Another thing, if you start out with a soil that has 3,000 calcium, it will not take near as much additives, so to speak, or so much in the drip line to bring the ergs up. I like the example of bouncing a golf ball off of a snowbank or off of a white cement wall. If you have a good foundation of calcium, you're bouncing the golf ball off of a cement wall. It'll come back and hit you hard. If you try to bounce a golf ball off of a snowbank, it'll go right in there and it'll disappear and you won't see it. And
right.
That is why, in a high calcium situation, the foliar feeds will do a lot more, the nutrient drenches will do a lot more, everything will come back and hit you a lot harder. It won't take near as much as in this situation. And that makes it a lot easier and a lot cheaper.
Okay, Dwayne, can you cover the foliar spraying, what you started with, what you ended up with, what you're doing now? And I'm actually going to set the phone down and I'll be back in 1 minute while you cover on foliar spraying. And if you need to take a break afterwards, just let me know. Okay?
I get the point.
Okay, so just cover what you did from the beginning and all the way up to what you're doing now. And then when I come back in, I want to hear if there's any lessons learned. I want to get that and write those down, okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, what
Thank
we
you.
Started out with was foliar spraying with brick plaster to put more blossoms on. We didn't have blossoms. We needed blossoms. We needed more fruit. Brick plaster is a foliar spray that John has that really puts on blossoms. It really does. this sounds kind of goofy, but if brick plaster does not put on blossoms, you've got another problem. What I'm saying is, never say never, never say always. just after that ice storm, just after that 39 degrees in that greenhouse, just after that, brick plaster didn't work too well. Why not? Because the plants were extremely stressed from the cold temperatures, and so you have to take everything into account. Anyway, we sprayed with brick plaster when we came on down through there, and it works good. And then there's another product that's called Enthuse, and that works very, very well for plant stress. It's an excellent product to bring the bricks up in the plant and in the leaf. In the plant and in the fruit. And we have seen the bricks and the leaves go from, well, they were at 4, and then they went up to 11, and now he's foliar spraying with Enthuse, and we're getting the milk in there, and the bricks and the leaf is actually up to 15 right now.
And, okay, Dwayne, I'm back. Just keep going.
Okay, the big lesson that we got out of this was when he started foliar spraying with the brick blaster, he said, "Dwayne, this stuff doesn't work." I said, "Oh, well, what's the problem?" "Well, it burns." And I was checking the bricks and leaf, and it doesn't really go up. The big lesson is don't put it on too thick. Do not put it on too thick. And there we come back to the sodium issue or the high ergs issue, high nitrates. If the ergs is very high, say 2,000 or 1,500 even, then the foliar sprays will burn the plant more readily. Now, how much should you put on? Well, how big are your plants? What are you using? What water are you using? There's a lot of questions like that. In my opinion, you should always use distilled water or rainwater or pond water for foliar feeding.
What about reverse osmosis water?
I have used that a little bit, but I prefer distilled. It just seems that it works better. It brings a better plant response. The big thing is make sure that the ergs in your water is under 50 that you use to foliar spray. That's the big thing. And so back to the amounts. In this 30 by 96 with 600 big plants in there, we're using slightly less than half a gallon, around half a gallon of liquid to foliar spray that greenhouse. And that's enough. And if you're going to do it more than once a day, cut the rate in half as far as the concentrate going into the water.
Okay, I think what you said then is even if you got a recommendation, you have to be looking at the plants and cut it back if needed.
Yes, yes. Yeah. You need to use your head for something else besides the hat rack.
Okay.
You need to watch the plants, and if something... I just had a call this morning from a greenhouse grower, and he said, "Dwayne, one of the foliar sprays, it's not working. It doesn't work. I spray it on the plant," and this is small plants as he's starting. He said, "I spray it on the plant, and they just droop down. It looks like they're going to die. It doesn't work. What should I do?" I said, "Well, can you see on the leaf that you sprayed it?" He said, "Oh, yeah, we get it on there." I said, "Well, you're putting on too much. You're putting on too much. Use way, way, way less. You need to have the finest mist possible. Just let it drift down on the leaves. I like to hold the nozzle at least 2 foot away from the leaves. Just let it drift lightly down onto the leaves. You should not be able to see much moisture at all on that leaf."
In other words, you're almost making a do and just kind of letting it just kind of come to the plant that way. Not a do, a fog.
Well, what you want to do is just increase the mineral content in the air. That's the bottom line, really. But yeah, atomize it as fine as you can and just let it drift, just a fog. That's excellent. And then the hairs on the plant can pick that up out of the air just fine. And don't wet the leaf down with foliar sprays that are not intended to wet the leaf, or you'll have burning issues and so on.
Okay, so you primarily use Brix Blaster and Enthuse?
Yes.
And you use them separately or together?
Separately.
Okay, Brix Blaster is a foliar spray that promotes blossoms. It feeds the plant NPK calcium, but it is a strong energy to reproduce. Enthuse is a broad spectrum trace mineral foliar spray. We've added quite a bit of trace minerals. It also includes some PGRs, some single amino acids, and I spike it with some of the things I know we need, such as selenium and iodine in very dilute quantities, to make sure we're bringing that up.
In my language, Enthuse is a vitamin B shot to the human. I don't know if there's any of that in there, but that's a good way to put it for the growers. It's just like a nutrient shot for the plant.
We'll get the other mulch on. Hurry up. Okay.
And I was telling them, John, that right through that ice, or just after the ice storm, the Brix Blaster didn't work very well at opening flowers. So never say never, never say always. But generally speaking, Brix Blaster does a wonderful job at making a plant bloom.
Right. So you felt like the Enthuse did a good job there, though, of helping it through plant stress?
Big time, yes. Very much.
Okay. Okay, any lessons else besides, I've got Brix Blaster or any foliar sprays will not work if they're too concentrated, so be willing to cut back the concentration, reduce the amounts, make fine mist. The other thing is we found that distilled water works really good for foliar sprays, otherwise pond water, collected rainwater, try to keep it under 50 ergs. Any other lessons that are real takeaway lessons?
One thing I would like to mention is in the backpack sprayers. A lot of us use solos, and I just found out that the SP systems, it's SP on the back of the sprayer, will build up to 150 PSI. They have a more durable tip that can produce a finer mist, and it does a lot better job. As far as a backpack pump-up sprayer, I prefer the SP. Over the Solo now. I thought Solo was the best.
So the SP, is that a brand? Is that a brand?
Yes, it's, well, yeah, I guess. It's SP Systems right on the back of that backpack blower. Where I find it is Ben Meadows or Forester Supply or, you know, one of those companies, they sell it. I'm not sure if Gempler sells SP or not, but, yeah, that's a...
So you're saying that SP will have a higher... velocity of spray and probably finer mist?
It will have a finer mist, definitely. Definitely will, because it has a higher PSI, higher pressure. They use a different pump. It's a diaphragm with a piston in it. A diaphragm pump generally goes to 60 PSI, and the piston pumps generally go to 90. The way they describe it in the ad is that they have a diaphragm with a piston in it. So we still have, we can still do the powders and so on through the backpack, because with a diaphragm pump, the powders don't get down into the piston, so it works great. But this one goes 150 PSI. I was just looking at that today. And my friend Jason has an SP, and I'm sure that that will atomize it finer, will put out a finer fog than my Solo backpack.
Okay, and now these SP sprayers, are they still, you're just hand pumping though, is that right?
That's right. It's hand
okay.
pump, goes on your back, three,
wow,
four
and
gallons.
Still can get up to 150 PSI.
Yes.
Wow.
That's what the ad said. I'm going to buy one because my...
What kind of a tip is on there?
It's a brass or a copper tip, and you can just, it's adjustable. You just turn it for a fog or screw it out for a stream.
So the tip that comes with the SP sprayer would be fine?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And see, the Solo just has a plastic, so I'm thinking, I'm glad I saw that, because that's what I'm going to get now.
Well, excellent. Well, it's, so you've basically, through the course of the beginning of the program, you started with some foliar sprays, and you have begun to, you increase the frequency. I imagine you covered that, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. No, I didn't cover that very well. To start with, I was more concerned about getting the ergs up in the soil, because I knew that with low ergs, foliar feeding, here we go again. Never say never, never say always. But with low ergs, foliar feeding is generally a waste of time. But then again, it's not a waste of time, because the foliar feeding that you put on the plant goes down through the plant and into the roots and helps to build up the soil. But it's not a good way to build up the soil because it's very slow, very difficult, very expensive. So foliar feeding, when the herbs is that low, generally does not bring visible return very fast at all. So when the herbs came up, say, to 400, 450, 500, we started increasing the frequency of the foliar sprays, and then you could see more response also.
Interesting.
So now we're foliar spraying every day in this one.
You're foliar spraying every day, and that's one time per day.
Pardon?
One time per day.
One time, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. He might occasionally do it twice, but basically we're aiming at once a day foliar spray, and the flowers are opening very nicely. The clusters are forming good. Another thing I want to point out is cracks. Everybody that grows tomatoes knows what cracks is in tomatoes. And when the herbs was that low, before January 12th, they had 50% or more cracked tomatoes. And now, well, actually, 2 weeks ago, we figured up what the percentage was, and it was down to 15%. Now, I don't know if it will improve that dramatically, you know, in other situations or not, but it was a huge improvement just by bringing the herbs up. Now, John, you explained that. We're sizing faster, we're growing faster, but it's not splitting as bad.
Okay. I'm going to theorize something, but I don't know if it's true. I'm going to look at the soil test to see. Maybe they'll back me up. But one of the things is we are putting the marine in, which is a broad-spectrum trace mineral, and we're putting fish, which is broad-spectrum trace mineral from the oceans, and we're putting Enthuse, which is broad-spectrum foliar spray, and all that, we're adding a certain amount of copper. And copper helps to the plant to have the bark to stretch, so it can help to prevent splits. Were you putting any specifically any chelated copper in here?
We did once or twice.
Okay, so not frequently though.
But not frequently, because on the soil test the copper is showing high.
Okay, and I'm going to tell, when we began in January the copper was showing 3.3. But when we look in March, it's showing 4.6 parts per million.
Mm-hmm.
So we've seen some increase here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's my recommendation that tomato ground, you want to have it in the upper 3s to up to 5 parts per million on copper, because you want to prevent the cracks and the splits. And when I listened to Dr. Reams on some tapes, and his idea was when you got splits on tomatoes, check the copper, and you're probably going to need to add some. And
I got another.
Go ahead.
I got another lesson here. Don't leave the water on overnight.
Okay. Big lesson.
Yeah, he had 6 inches of water in that greenhouse, and the herbs were up around 600. Staying up there, 600, 650, 580, and then we all make mistakes, but anyway, he forgot the water and left it on overnight, and it dropped down 450, then 400, then 350, and we immediately started putting in more products, more of the different things, you know, and adding some different, I added in some more potassium, I added in a little phosphorus, and then today it's back up to 650. So we got over that one okay.
Okay, so what's your goal right now as you look at the tomatoes and the blossoms and the bricks of the leaves? What's your goal for ergs as you're trying to stabilize at this point where you're producing heavily, you have a lot of tomato that you're filling, plus you're still putting on new blossoms?
Right now, with this guy's water, which his water has 170 or 200 ergs, something like that, my goal is 700.
Okay, so you would like to keep it around 700?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's with water at around 200. Mm-hmm. And they do very nicely there.
Okay. So just a couple things that I recall. If you kind of monitor the bricks reading of the leaves, if you see a sudden drop, what's that mean to you?
Well, you messed up somewhere. And it means, if you see, let's see, okay, you said if you see a sudden drop in the bricks.
Let's say you're at 11 bricks and you suddenly went down to 600.
Well,
sorry,
monitor,
excuse me, 11 to 6.
If you're monitoring your herbs, you'll probably see it in the herbs as quickly as you'll see it in the leaf, or a little quicker. There's any number of situations that could cause that, but what that means is that the plant is no longer making new cells at the rate that you want it to make new cells, or it's not producing healthy cells, because the leaf is the sugar factory for the plant. That's where it synthesizes its protein. And so you have to go back and you say, okay, the bricks in the leaf is dropping. That means the sugars in the leaf is dropping. That means the photosynthesis is not happening as it should. That means, and you just need to keep on going back and going back and using deductive thought and go over your records. What did we do different? What happened? There's no one thing, John, that I can put my finger on and say, okay, that's what it is.
You know, okay. What I mean? One of the things I would say is look at the crop and see, are you going through a phase change in the crop physiology? Are you suddenly having a higher demand because maybe it's filling, you know, if you go from just putting on little ones to filling bigger ones and plus putting on new clusters, that's a big change. And so it might be a possibility to see if maybe you have to raise your base level of herbs.
Okay, that's a good point. I was going to say you could probably see that in the herbs, but you're saying if you go through a change, you might have to raise the base level.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So if you're watching the leaves, and you know, let's say you're keeping your herbs at 400, and all of a sudden your leaves drop from 11 to 6, probably raise, you know, my first thing is raise your herbs up a little higher and keep it, maybe try keeping it at 550. And see what it does, and the leaves might come right back up.
Mm-hmm. Well, generally, you will see that in the ergs anyhow, because the ergs isn't going to sit there. If you take the ergs every day, you will detect that in the ergs when it starts.
Mm-hmm.
You will. When it starts forming seed, when it starts to fill fruit, any of those changes, you can detect that. The ergs tells you so much. It's amazing. It's really amazing.
Okay, I have a couple questions. What happens when the conductivity, the pH, is too high? How do we manage it to get it back down into the optimum range?
In the soil?
Yeah, so the ergs, the ECB electrical conductivity, so ergs and pH gets high.
Both?
Yes.
At the same time?
Yeah.
Well, what's soil test say? That would be the first thing. It depends on where the herbs is coming from. That brings to mind, of course, greenhouse in Iowa, where the herbs was way high, and it was a low calcium situation. So we did add calcium in the form of micronized lime. Sometimes that can just turn into a tiger, and you've got to hold the end of the tail, and that tiger weighs a ton. Sometimes it can turn into that, and there's not a whole lot you can do except try to ride it out and stay on your feet.
So in other words, we could do some fertigation of the micronized lime, and that program with no soluble nutrients, really, but try to get some more available calcium there.
The number one thing is don't put on more of what you have enough of. That's number one. It's so simple and so basic. Don't put on more of what you have adequately already. Don't do it.
Now, did Daniel Beachy Strawberries, did he have a situation with high ergs and high pH and we were fertigating?
He had a very high ergs.
And I thought it was kind of a little bit higher pH, too.
I'll grab the file here.
Okay.
But what I'm saying is if you have a high ergs, you have high levels of nutrients, sometimes you really can't do a whole lot about it except sometimes you can water. That's one thing you can do. Use low conductivity water. And if you have a soil that percolates well, you're lucky, and just water it and just flood it.
This would be a lot easier. It would be a lot easier to do that if you didn't have plants. You could just really do a heavy washing of the water and maybe drop some of the ergs that way.
Yes, if you have plants, then you get watery crop. And I'm trying to find here. There's strawberries. Yeah, we had a 7.0 on the pH. We had 2,600 on the ergs. We had 700 on the calcium, 3,200 on potassium, and 2,800 on the phosphorus. That was a situation where we had high ergs, a 7 on the pH. Not too high, but it's high. And we did flush that one. We did flush it with water. We tried that. We had extremely low calcium at 700 pounds, so we fed it micronized lime to try to get a crop that was halfway decent, because we knew you can grow plants with... Oh, here's another thing. The nitrates were 250. And the sodium was very high at 72, so how much that was adding to that 2,600 on the ergs, I don't know. Probably a lot. To try to get a crop, we knew we had to have calcium in that cell. Go back to that cell. We knew we had to have calcium in there, so we added micronized lime. And that helped to buffer some of those high levels of elements. It helped to buffer those so the damage to the plant was less, and it gave us a calcium source, and we also put in bugs and sugar and so on to break down that calcium, so it gave us a calcium source so that we could get calcium into those cells, and we wound up getting a fair decent crop off of there. I guess it wasn't nothing outstanding, but it was better than nothing. So,
from what I remember, he was pretty happy about the crop that he did get.
Yeah. Yeah, the year before he had 200 pints, and this year was around 2,000 pints, something like that, same greenhouse. He had a little bit more plants, maybe the second year, but not much, not that much more. And the bricks on his strawberries, he had 7s to 9s, I believe, in that range. I think 9 was about the highest he got out of that greenhouse.
Okay. Well, that's interesting that he was able to get some production anyway and use the calcium in that.
And the other thing to those people who don't know about this situation, that greenhouse was put up over an old farmyard or barnyard. So don't put your greenhouses on old barnyards.
Okay, that's we hear it twice.
Well, that's like me. I need to hear it more than once.
Well, that's good. Did you cover when I was gone? Did you cover much on the use of milk going through the drip lines?
Not much.
Okay. Do you feel pretty? Do you feel like that's a valuable thing or tool?
I think it can be. From what we're seeing, I think it can be. We're seeing that it will help size the tomatoes very rapidly, or faster than. And here we go again, never say never, never say always, but our experience here is that it's helping the tomatoes to size, and it's bringing the bricks and the leaf up. Those leaves will just thicken. It's a very nice source of calcium and also phosphorus, and it will thicken those leaves. The bricks and the leaf is up to 15, and I attribute it some to the milk. We did pick up on the frequency of the foliar spraying, but I think the milk is doing some good things. And we are just using store milk, pasteurized, homogenized, and so on.
Okay, what kind? Whole milk, 2% skim?
I don't even know.
Okay.
I don't even know. I just told him to get some milk.
Okay, and I want to make a point that the milk always goes in fertigation number one, which is the growth side of things. There's way too many acids and problems that could coagulate and plug up some things in fertigation number two. So always keep that on the growth side.
Mm-hmm. And another thing is that we're putting in a little bit of vinegar. And when you're putting in micronized lime, that's a good thing, but you can overdo it easily, and that's why it's important to monitor your pH.
Okay, vinegar goes in fertigation number two.
Right, that goes with the reproductive site.
Okay.
And here's a very interesting thing. We were having pHs down close to 5. And so sometimes you have to fight fire with fire. So we started putting in 1 ounce of vinegar into this greenhouse in fertigation number 2, and that pH jumped up. It came up by adding that vinegar. In other words, we were solubilizing more of that micronized lime. This is a theory. Solubilizing more of that micronized lime, and the pH was coming up. We were creating a greater level of resistance, so we had more energy because there was more resistance to the flow.
Okay. So then are you continuing that then with the okay, and are you using apple cider vinegar?
Yes.
Okay. So looking here at your current more recent level of urge, you're in the 500 and 600 range, and then sometimes dropping down into the 400s.
So that was because of the overwatering.
The overwatering, okay. All right. So you think that you can get it back up in the 600s and maybe push it up to your ideal that you're looking at with 700?
Mm-hmm. It was 650 this morning.
Okay. And you are putting out some additional nitrogen besides the fish in the form of ammonium sulfate and maybe sometimes urea, or did you drop urea?
No, we're using urea
because
of the pH issue. Ammonium sulfate drives the pH down. Urea drives it up. And so we were alternating. Now, urea doesn't have quite the kick that ammonium sulfate does. In other words, it will not push the ergs as high as ammonium sulfate will. And urea is 46% nitrogen. Ammonium sulfate is 21-22% nitrogen. So if you do urea, cut the rate in half from ammonium sulfate. Don't overdo that. But we're going back and forth, because our pH is running down around 5, and we don't want it to go below that really. The plants are doing fine, so we're not having any bad effects. But we go in there with urea, and then we see the pH come up a little bit. The herbs goes down a little bit. We go back in there with ammonium sulfate. The herbs come back up. The pH goes back down. We're walking a tightrope across Niagara Falls, and we're playing this thing just as hard as we can play it to get production out of there that we can, so that they can get their money out of this thing.
Okay, let's bring that up. Are they making money now, or is it worthwhile for them to follow this program?
Yes. Yes, they weren't making anything. They said they weren't making anything. And so anything's better than that, but yes, at 500 pounds of tomatoes a week, and they're selling... They sell them local here for $3 a pound, and then the excess they were taking to a produce auction, and they were getting, I think they got $1.50, maybe, something like that, I'm not sure, but it wasn't nearly as much as they got locally, and they're working on local markets to sell more here locally, because obviously the price is better than at the auction, but yes, they are making money.
Okay, well, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about how, after following this program a little bit, we feel like the potassium has begun to slip, and then we have had to address potassium. And what do you look for signs for a shortage of potassium?
Well, this is thanks to David Yoder. We were seeing a lot of the cluster branches breaking or kinking. And the tomatoes do size very rapidly when you have the ergs at 600-700, the bricks and the leaves at 11 and 12 and above. The tomatoes size much faster than when the bricks and the leaf is at 6 and the ergs is at 400. I just blamed it on that. I thought we were sizing tomatoes very quickly and they need to get those clusters tied up. David Yoder told me that he almost never ties his clusters up. Doesn't need to, they don't break down. And he said that's a potassium issue. And so our last test came back, potassium at 257, is that correct?
Let's see, the most recent 200. One was, yeah, 200.
200.
Yeah, so that's getting really pretty low in a greenhouse. That's low.
Mm-hmm. And so we're starting to put in some soluble, high pH potassium. And we just started that 3-4 days ago, so it's too early to tell what that will do as far as helping to increase the strength of those cluster stems.
So watch clusters bending over as a potassium shortage.
I would say so. Mm-hmm. That's what David told me, and it makes sense to me because potassium is what holds the fruit onto the plant. So we're not actually talking about the attachment of the tomato to the plant. We're talking about the branch coming out of the tomatoes. But potassium also determines the caliber of the stem. So I think it's a good theory.
Well, I know there's been some problems. Some people can, I've heard some stories of people getting real excited about micronized limestone and fertigating. And potassium was not addressed, and it was definitely to the detriment of crop yield and crop quality. So we don't want to emphasize calcium to the point of excluding potassium.
That brings up another point. If your nutrients are way out of whack on your soil test, you can have adequate levels or excessive levels of this or that, and you can come up with a potassium shortage for the plant in some situations. In this situation, we had a extreme nitrogen shortage, and all the elements go into a plant phosphate form except nitrogen. And nitrogen can take up potassium. So generally, when you're high in potassium, you're going to have plenty of it because usually you have plenty of nitrogen to take it into the plant. Well, if you're extremely low on nitrogen, nitrate nitrogen specifically, and ammonia nitrogen, I don't know if it makes a difference there, but your potassium uptake is not going to be happening with nitrogen. So you could, you know, if you have a problem with nutrient uptake, which we did, I'm just saying the potassium levels on the first test was 400 and something. That doesn't mean that we had enough in the plant. And, yeah, I can hear you say, well, do a tissue analysis. Well, we have done, no, we haven't done any tissue analysis on this one. But that doesn't always tell the whole story. I'd rather go with a soil test and a conductivity meter any day than with a tissue analysis. I think a guy can raise a lot better crops with a good soil test, conductivity meter, and a pH meter, than with a tissue analysis.
Yeah, and you probably want to throw in a bricks meter there to keep checking the leaves and stuff like that once in a while.
Very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Definitely.
Well, that's been a lot of things that we learned. I'm really very appreciative for this interaction with you and you with Gary on the spot on there, because we've all been learning, and that's really the purpose of this call, is to try to see if we can get some points clear about this thing and get some principles down on papers to think about. Do you have anything you would like to add, Dwayne, on different things, the overall ideas?
Yes.
Okay.
On the overall idea, don't take any one thing it's not the way it works. You have to have everything working together. That is one. That's one last thought I would like to give. Do not run with any one thing. You have to have the soil test. You have to have the conductivity. You have to have the pH. You have to have the lime. You have to have the nitrogen. You have to have potassium. Don't take any one thing and hold it up and say, this is what we need. We're going. You need to figure out what you need, where you are, why you need it, how much you need, and then use it. And sometimes you have to do a little bit of experimenting and hope you're on the right track.
Yes. And, you know, and I would say this. Don't take the soil test and the recommendations and follow just that.
That's right.
I mean, that is only a snapshot in time. So you've got to, the farmer, the grower, has to be monitoring daily, especially in the greenhouse, and adjusting. Because, in making recommendations, we can only give a suggested or a beginning. So the tomatoes might be, pre-bloom when I get the soil test and I make a recommendation, but the situations change, and so you've got to be able to adapt with that crop.
I'm glad you brought that up. Don't take the recommendations as a hard, fast rule. It's a good foundation. It's excellent foundation, but then when you get into the solubles, there's no way to forecast everything that's going to happen. What if you overwater? Then you need to put in more to bring the herbs back up. What if, you know? So that's a very good point.
And I think I'm writing that down as a real takeaway, is that you have to add to it. And you can start with that, but then monitor and adjust.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, any thoughts on what would you think of trying to do this whole thing organically for a few people that may be growing this organically? Any thoughts on that?
Well, it's kind of like taking a canoe trip up to Missouri. Doing it this way, and now when I say conventional, I'm not talking about chemicals or spraying chemicals. We're working with it as hard as we can to do everything we can to get the nutrition up in the plant, in the fruit that we eat. That's the goal. That's the bottom line. Okay, so doing it this way, and we're taking a canoe trip up to Missouri. We've got two guys in the canoe, two strong guys, and both have a good paddle, and we're heading up to Missouri. Going upstream, we're going pretty good. Now, if we want to go organic, only one guy has a paddle, and one of his arms are tied behind his back. We might get there. But, boy, it's going to be hard work. That's kind of my thoughts on it. Now, that might be exaggerated for clarity, but can it be done? Yeah. That also depends on where you're starting from. If you have a nice situation to start from, if you have enough phosphorus, if you have enough, then it might be a piece of cake. Now, thinking about this situation that we just covered tonight, trying to do this organically, no, I don't think so. So it depends on where you're starting from.
Okay, well, that's a good point. I really appreciate your point. David Allen, are you online? Can you speak? I gave him the access. Okay, well...
Can he just push *6 or something like that?
Yeah, he might have muted himself. I don't know. But *6, if he didn't call in with the organizer, I just want him to see if he had a few words to say. If he does, fine. We'll just go in for a few more minutes, and then if he does not, we're going to call it a night.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, well, I think, we didn't cover greenhouse number 2, but I think that's fine. We got the major principles out of greenhouse number 1.
Mm-hmm.
One thing, I guess, Wendell was there with Dr. Scow and I one time, and a few other things that we noticed. Wendell noticed that if you're going to be planting these tomatoes that are going to hang down from the greenhouse like these are, and they're hanging on the tie-up thing, it would probably be good to plant the tomato at an angle so that when you have to lower the tomato plants, there's not a breaking at the base of the plant. So that would be another one, is planted at about a 45 degree angle in the direction that, so you can start to wrap that around without causing a big break or a kink basically at the root. The other thing to note was that these are all hybrid tomatoes, as far as I am aware, and so maybe as we get the soil right, we might be able to experiment with a plant or two that are not hybrids and see what we get with bricks. So, but we, in everything we're talking about tonight, we were talking about hybrid tomatoes. Can you confirm that?
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Another thing that you have to be careful about is your water quality. That can be a big issue.
It is my conclusion that long-term, we have discussed, and long-term, it's probably good to get a system that cleans up the water, even for the fertigation. Maybe putting in some kind of a system, maybe RO or something that will clean it up, especially if you have a little higher conductivity. Okay, that's all I got. And we're going to hang this up. I want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll try to get this made available. I'd also like to offer people, I'll try to get a copy of all of these takeaway points and put that up as a download, or if you're not doing internet, if you want to call the office after about a week or so, we can probably have that available. We can mail it out. Just some of the takeaway points from this. And again, thank you, and thank you, Dwayne, and especially give our thanks to Gary and Eldon for their willingness to share and let this be talked about.
Well, thanks a lot, John, and I hope it was a help. I hope it can help people to better monitor and to better produce better crops.
Okay. And I guess with that, we'll say God bless and good night.
Good night, John.
Okay, bye.